Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I would like to know is, I'm sure people have lost their homes due to tax default or whatever. What's the compensation going to be for those who were overtaxed inadvertently and then lost their homes, you know?
Well, we begin today's show in Detroit, where a showdown between grassroots activists and the city is shining a spotlight on racist housing policies that robbed African Americans in Detroit of their homes and widened the wealth gap. On Thursday, with the support of Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the Coalition for Property Tax Justice announced a class action lawsuit against the city of Detroit, Wayne County, and the state of Michigan in response to unfair property tax foreclosures. One in four Detroit properties have been subject to property tax foreclosure, a level comparable only to the foreclosure rates during the Great Depression. And according to legal experts, many of them were caused by illegally inflated property taxes that violated the state's own constitution. Even though Detroit tried to fix the problem in 2017, it's still overvaluing the lowest-priced homes. This is lifelong Detroit resident Sandra Bonet speaking during a press conference on Thursday. In 2015, her home was illegally foreclosed by Wayne County, which includes the city of Detroit.
Right now, what I tell the community every time I go out, it feels very personal to lose your home. You feel like you did something very wrong, like you just couldn't keep it together. But once I was informed by Professor Atuahene that the city illegally and unconstitutionally took my home, oh, it lit a fire. And we began fighting. And this is where this fight has brought us. So I want to leave you with a couple of things today. Number one, this is an 85% black city. This would not be happening if this city was 85% white. You better believe that. Two is, land is so very important. And they are stealing your land. We cannot let them get away with this yet again, because Lord knows they've stolen enough land.
Detroit is now 80% African American, and 40% of Detroit's residents live below the federal poverty level. But as downtown Detroit becomes increasingly gentrified, thousands of Detroit's longtime residents, mostly African American families, have lost their homes to foreclosure for property taxes they should not have been paying in the first place, because the poverty tax exemption excuses those in poverty from paying. Well, for more, we go to Detroit, Michigan, where we're joined by Democratic Congress member Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, who's worked on this lawsuit from before the time she entered Congress. And we're joined by Bernadette Atuahene, a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law and research professor at the American Bar Foundation, member of the Coalition for Property Tax Justice. She's most recent study is titled Predatory Cities, forthcoming in the UC Berkeley Law Review later this month. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Congressmember Tlaib, you went back to Detroit for this major news conference. Talk about why this is so critical in your town, in your city of Detroit.
You know, I represent the third poorest congressional district in the country out of 435 congressional seats in the nation. And the human impact of what it feels like to not be offered the same equal rights that the majority of other Michiganders were getting. I mean, the due process of being able to get noticed, to be able to have the right to appeal, but also the right to have your home assessed every year as required by not only the city charter, but the Michigan state constitution. So many of my residents, before I ever got elected, were coming to the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice saying, something's not right here. I don't know. Why did I get this after the deadline? What is happening here? And when we filed the FOIA, we found out 260,000 Detroiters received the notice either late or even past the deadline. And it was devastating. The fact that they didn't even get the right to appeal it. And what we hear from the city administration and those folks that are in power to make the change is, well, it's their fault. They didn't do anything about it. But you didn't give them the option to do anything about it. So that's why I'm really commending the coalition and what we call the Detroit's professor over here, Bernadette, for pushing forward and speaking truth. I think that's what's been really hard. You heard from a mother recently of seven children, and she felt like she did something wrong. And when she finally felt, you know, heard the data, heard that she was actually cheated out of her home. It felt liberating in some sense that she did. She wasn't the one that was in the wrong. She shouldn't feel ashamed. The city of Detroit and those in power should feel ashamed.
And Congresswoman, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the how this crisis is affecting not just Detroit, but across the nation, in terms of the wealth of especially of African Americans and Latinos, because of the seizures of their homes and especially resulting from after 2008 mortgage meltdown, when so many other people went underwater.
Yeah, and that's one of the key things is, you know, homes are economic stability. But many folks, just the historic nature, not only from Chicago to other really beautifully historic cities, majority black cities, what you know is these are homes that the families have been in there generations, yes. Generations after generations. You could probably go back, and I remember I was telling Bernadette this, there was this woman who was born in her home. Senior citizen in her 70s and loses her home for less than $1,000. I mean, it's devastating to see something so ripped away from you. But yes, economic stability is so tied to home ownership. And the fact of the matter is, it's not only what happened here with this tax foreclosure crisis and, you know, I think illegal taking, is that we also see that big banks, mortgage industry, others, there are still institutional systemic racism within their processes. We see it with settlement cases all across the country over and over again. I remember specifically in Financial Services Committee, hearing about a whistleblower within Wells Fargo that was saying that he was taught and trained that if somebody came in with an accent to give a higher interest rate. So our communities of color all across the United States are facing barriers after barriers, yeah, and these structural kind of racist approaches and processes. To me, what happened to many of my Detroit neighbors and not being offered due process and getting their homes taken away from them was completely wrong. The devastating part of it, too, was after I got into the United States Congress, when I found out millions of dollars that was sent to Detroit to address the blight, to address this housing crisis— when I found out that Detroit was ready, and I already had known this, Detroit was responsible for much of that. So the federal government is trying to fix an issue that was created by the own city administration is wrong. Look, it's in the charter. It's the law of the land in the city. You're supposed to assess people's homes. Walking away from your responsibility and your duty, saying that, oh, everybody got notice, but you gave them notice after the deadline that they could actually appeal, is simply wrong. And I think if you ask anybody across this country, the access to fairness and due process is so key. And that's why I think the class action suit is important. Not only do we have to fight in the streets to tell the truth and tell our stories, also on to the House floor of Congress or many other local governments, but also through the courts, do we have to demand that we're treated with respect and dignity, to take people's homes away from them, where their children lives, their neighborhood, everything is ripped from them, all because somebody decided they didn't deserve it. They didn't deserve the process or equality and due process that everybody else gets around the state.
Professor Bernadette Atuahene, you teach at Illinois Institute of Technology at the law school there. You've done deep research into the racial wealth gap. If you can talk about the facts and figures behind this lawsuit, what it has meant, and how the Detroit mayor is currently responding to the class action suit and dealing with this illegal seizure of tax money or throwing people out of their homes.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. So the first thing I want people to know is in Detroit, we have 1 in 4 homes that have gone through property tax foreclosure. 1 in 4. We haven't seen this number of property tax foreclosures in American history since the Great Depression. So the real question is, what is going on? And so I've done research that shows that between 2009 and 2015, anywhere in each of those 7 years, anywhere between 55 and 85% of properties were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution, which clearly says no property is to be assessed at more than 50% of its market value. And then when we looked at which houses were being overassessed, we found that 95% or more of the lowest valued homes were being overassessed, while the highest valued homes were actually being underassessed. And so the next study we did is because anytime you do research in Detroit and you don't deal with race directly, you're doing everyone a disservice. So the next study we did is we looked at Wayne County, and we looked at all the municipalities of Wayne County, and there's 3 that have a supermajority of African-Americans, 70% or more, Detroit, Inkster, and Highland Park. And each of those majority black cities were being subjected to these unconstitutional tax assessments and foreclosures at a greater rate than the majority white cities. The third and final study we did looked at the relationship between these unconstitutional tax assessments and foreclosure rates. Because, in fact, there's lots of things that can cause foreclosure, right? Poverty, a death in the family, etc. And so we needed to hold all of those variables constant to really isolate the effect of this one variable of unconstitutional tax assessments on foreclosure rates. And we're able to say that 10% of these historic rates of tax foreclosure in Detroit would not have happened but for these unconstitutional property tax assessments. That's 10% of all foreclosures. And when you look at just the kind of lowest valued homes, we are able to say 1 in 4 or 25% of those foreclosures would not have happened but for these unconstitutional property tax assessments. The city and the mayor in specific, their response to this overwhelming empirical evidence of illegality is to say, you know, if you thought you were being overassessed, you should have, in fact, filed an appeal, right? So moving the blame, the onus from the city to do the property tax assessments correctly to homeowners to, you know, saying they should have appealed. But what this lawsuit is all about, as Representative Tlaib has so clearly pointed out, is about the fact that the city did not even give people a chance to appeal. Why? Because in 2017, they mailed the property tax assessment notices late. And so they mailed them, in fact, late after the appeal deadline, meaning that Detroiters did not have an opportunity to appeal these illegally inflated property taxes. And that is the heart of this particular lawsuit. It is a due process lawsuit. Again, just fighting on behalf of Detroiters who are being overassessed and not given an opportunity to fight back.
And Professor, I wanted to ask you, obviously, that the super high assessments meant that those homeowners, especially in the poorest communities, were being required to pay more property taxes, right? Now, we're in a situation now, obviously, Detroit was in financial crisis for many years, and now all of these reports about how Detroit is coming back. What is the real story now as to how Detroit is coming back?
That's right. And let's just put this in context. Detroit has the highest property tax rate in the state of Michigan. It has the second highest tax rate in the United States. On top of these already high tax rates, they're being illegally assessed, meaning on top of the highest tax rates in the country, they are now being taxed even more, right? And so that's the starting point. What was the question again?
Well, they keep saying Detroit's coming back, Bernadette.
Oh, yes.
And one of the things you should know is if you go to my neighborhoods, they don't think they're not coming back from whatever the heck their folks are saying they're coming back from. Poverty among children has actually increased in the city of Detroit. You see neighborhood after neighborhood that's been left behind. When they say come back, they're talking about the 7.2 miles. Yes. If you look at the census tracts, some of the wealthiest census tracts within the city of Detroit, they're talking about billionaires Dan Gilbert and the Illich family who continue to take tax giveaways from our school aid fund while literally down the street for their hockey stadium, for their for-profit development. While down the street, we have schools that don't have clean drinking water. We have schools that literally are closing down, these neighborhood schools that have been part of our anchors within our neighborhoods. So it is hard because I've actually had a senior citizen tell me, Detroit's coming back from where? And why are they continually talking about only the downtown area and the surrounding kind of areas there? It's like an island because anything beyond that island is real true poverty and people from those that can't afford their water bills, that literally one day their water gets shut off, the next day their children are being taken away from them. I mean, because they're saying, oh, they're negligent. But this is the same amount of money they're using for the for-profit industry that's even there for foster care. They won't even use it to help a woman get her water put back on. I mean, the hardship that we see our families facing, these are working class families. And even the young, the mother of seven, Sonia, she was saying that we're the ones out there in the restaurants that you don't look up and look at. We're the ones that are among you and your neighbors that have been part of the city of Detroit for so long. But they feel very truly left behind, not only with what's going on with property taxes, but what's going on, the devastation of our water shutoffs, the devastation of what's happening to our education system and so forth, the disinvestment in our neighborhoods that are surrounding downtown Detroit is extremely put such a tremendous hardship on so many of our families.
And we at the Coalition for Property Tax Justice like to think of the comeback story as a tale of two cities.
Yes.
Right? Because you have downtown Detroit. In downtown Detroit, the developers there are getting tax subsidies and tax breaks when in the neighborhoods, they're being unconstitutionally assessed and foreclosed on at historic rates. Yeah. So when you think about Detroit coming back, again, as Representative Tlaib said, it's about a comeback for 7 square miles that includes downtown. When you look at the rest of Detroit, the majority of Detroit, and let's get real, Black Detroit, there is no comeback.
That's right.
That's why we have to think as Black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking.
Wow.
Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV.
The book we're about to discuss almost didn't exist. Little Legends celebrates exceptional men in Black history. It's by the author-illustrator Vashti Harrison. She deliberated over whether to take on this subject matter. She says she relates more to women's stories.
My first book, Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, came out in 2017, and it came from a really personal place. I was thinking about the stories that I needed to see when I was a little kid. But from the moment it got announced, people were asking me, are you going to write one about Black men as well?
Well, eventually she gave in, seeing high demand for a follow-up. On every other page of Little Legends, Vashti Harrison's detailed illustrations bring each of her profiles to life in this really cool way. I asked her about why she chose to draw all of them with their eyes closed.
I really wanted to create this sweet, simple character. You know, I could have drawn each of these famous people to look like themselves, but I wanted to create a child character and kind of make it look like they were almost dressing up as these famous people.
Mm.
They've got their eyes closed with this sweet smile, and I wanted it to feel like they're kind of imagining themselves in the worlds of these wonderful people. But I also wanted to create a beautiful book, a beautiful object, and I wanted it to feel kind of vintage, a little bit classic. And so I was thinking about these classic mid-century artists from the golden age of picture books. And I really wanted to make something that featured characters of color, people of color, in a book that looks like it belongs on the shelf next to Winnie the Pooh and Madeline and Eloise.
Well, how did you choose the 35 men you wanted to profile?
It was not easy. There was, I think, originally a list of about 100 people. Obviously, so many incredible people could have gone in. But one thing that was really important for me in the first book that I carried over into this one was showcasing a diverse list of fields of study. Sure, there are doctors and lawyers and activists, but also engineers and cyclists and artists. Because there's a question that a lot of adults ask kids, and I don't really like this question so much. When I was little, I didn't love it, but it's, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah, we were all asked that, huh?
Yeah.
It felt so much pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you should have to know too early.
No.
Great if you do, but also cool if you don't. But I wanted to be able to fill kids up with the knowledge of all these different paths and fields of study, so when they're ready to answer, they'll know about all these cool folks that came before them.
I noticed that, I mean, you talked about you didn't want it just to be the most famous people, and you bring up like Barack Obama, Martin Luther King Jr. at the end just to say, like, of course these people were important, but those weren't the ones you really decided to dig into and profile at length.
Yeah, originally, you know, when I was thinking about my first book, I was thinking about Black History Month and why is it that we actually celebrate Black History Month? When Carter G. Woodson founded Negro History Week in 1926, his goal was to celebrate the stories that have been long neglected throughout history. So I felt like here's an opportunity to showcase some names that you wouldn't maybe come across in the mainstream. So when you go to the bookstore, there are lots of books featuring Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama. I wanted to be able to, you know, showcase some names that you may not see everywhere else. So like Bass Reeves and John Robinson. But obviously there are some big names because I worried, you know, I hoped that, you know, people would share this book. And just in case it was someone's first introduction to Black history, there are a few big names. There's, you know, Frederick Douglass and
Prince. Prince is pretty big.
And Prince is pretty big, yeah.
So many of the men you feature here were doing extraordinary things despite racism they faced. And you said that you were struck by how they responded. I mean, that a lot of what you enjoyed was realizing that they weren't full of hate or resentment, that they kept a really inspiring attitude in the face of such horrific things.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally understandable for those experiences. But what I really wanted kids to connect with was this passion and joy that a lot of these people found in the things that they were doing. Someone like Major Taylor, who faced incredible racism and prejudice in the cycling industry, he still went after his love and enjoyed it and found beauty in it. And I really wanted to be able to share that with kids.
This is probably unfair to do to an author who's written 35 profiles, but could you pick one more that you want to tell us a little bit more about?
Sure. I mean, I definitely have a soft spot for the artists. So one of my favorites is Aaron Douglas, for sure.
Uh-huh.
You know, his work was just really just so beautiful. He was a master of color. I mean, he was making artwork for and about Black people in a time before anyone considered Black to be beautiful. And he just made his work so unique. He combined Art Deco and Cubism and Egyptian hieroglyphics to create this bold style that became the look for the Harlem Renaissance. Like, his work was everywhere on posters, on book covers, in magazines. And I love everything he's created.
I want to ask you, I want to return to kind of what we were talking about, like what these men did in the face of racism. Like how do you want parents and like their kids who are reading this to confront that question? You know, and like a young mind just learning about race and some of the horrible things that our country has been through and some of the terrible things that these men have faced, what to do in the face of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a harsh reality that a lot of parents of color, children of color, experience often way too early. But what I really want them to know is that through hard work, through grace, through kindness, and through passion, these people found and created lives that were meaningful and made work that was meaningful for other people. It was tough tackling some of these subjects. It's dark. Our history is dark sometimes. And I found it was really important to just put it all out there. You know, it was reality. And so I really just want these young readers to know that that didn't define them. These hardships didn't define them, but it was their love and their kindness and their goodness that made a difference in the world.
Author, illustrator Vashti Harrison, her latest book is called Little Legends, Exceptional Men in Black History. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The role plan was conditioning us, preparing us, because we were going to face opposition, possibility of us being beaten. We have to be prepared.
I have many sweet memories of getting flowers for Valentine's Day. There's a reason that long-stem red roses have become synonymous with the February 14th celebration. They make a statement. But the older I get, I find more joy in gifting flowers, and not just on Valentine's Day. I send bouquets any day of the year to people I care about and love. I want them to know now how I feel about them. Country singer Tanya Tucker underscores exactly how I feel in her new hit song, Bring Me My Flowers Now. Tucker sings, "Bring me my flowers now while I'm living. I won't need your love when I'm gone." In the spirit of that song and in anticipation of Valentine's Day this Friday, I'm offering my roses today for Congressman John Lewis, a giant of the civil rights movement. Last December, he announced he was suffering from stage 4 pancreatic cancer. The news shattered me. I interviewed him for the landmark series Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, and for forums at Boston's Kennedy Library. He addressed the grim diagnosis head on, saying, "I have been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for nearly my entire life." That's an understatement. Congressman Lewis is living history. He joined the civil rights movement as a teenager. At 21 years old, he was a freedom rider, one of the mostly young civil rights organizers, testing the federal law desegregating interstate buses in the South. It was a dangerous mission, so dangerous the volunteer riders wrote their wills before they boarded the buses. John Lewis was the first to be hit by a mob opposed to the law and the group's journey. So determined was he to make a change in this country, he continued to put himself on the front lines. In 1965, he led the historic march for voting rights, now known as Bloody Sunday, quietly facing Alabama state troopers who nearly beat him to death. John Lewis left decades of nonviolent protest in the streets to take on a new role in the House of Representatives. He's in his 17th term in Congress, where he's built a reputation as a stalwart supporter of legislation protecting the rights of Americans most at risk and a vocal advocate for laws embracing humanity. Since 1986, he's represented the citizens of Georgia, where he's long been praised as a moral compass by both sides of the aisle. His cancer announcement was met with genuine concern for his health and for what the prognosis may mean. Congressman Lewis started his cancer treatment just as the impeachment proceedings got underway in the House. His passionate statement on the floor of the House echoed his clear-eyed commitment to democracy. He said, "For some, this vote may be hard, but we have a mission and a mandate to be on the right side of history." Tanya Tucker's song ends with these poignant words, "If your heart is in them flowers, bring them on." Happy Valentine's Day, Congressman John Lewis. It's especially meaningful to honor your service during this Black History Month. I appreciate your lifelong fight for an America that includes everyone. Please accept my virtual flowers right now. I'm Callie Crossley, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
The controlled press, the white press, inflames the white public against Negroes.
Starting tomorrow, Americans will have a new TV channel they can turn to for news.
You're watching
BNC Morning Edition,
weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
The Black News Channel, or BNC, says it will bring news and educational programming that is, quote, culturally specific to the African-American community, unquote. The channel will be available on some cable networks and streaming online, starting with its first broadcast at 6 a.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. Former Republican Congressman J.C. Watts is the co-founder and chairman of BNC, and he is with us now from Norman, Oklahoma, to tell us more. Congressman Watts, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations.
Michelle, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I understand that you have been working on this for some time now, nearly a decade, so that would have to make it a passion project for you. What gave you the idea? What need do you see that isn't being met with the existing offerings?
In mainstream news, you have nothing that is culturally specific to the African American community. And MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, they will have black faces on their shows, but they're never talking about, when it comes to wellness, talking about sickle cell, talking about historical black colleges and universities. By and large, it's nothing speaking to us. And so I think there needs to be a more comprehensive story told about the African-American community, and we'll have a venue to do that.
There have been efforts at serious news publications or shows aimed at an African-American audience before that haven't been sustainable. I mean, I'm thinking about like Roland Martin's show. I'm thinking about Emerge Magazine. How do you determine that there is a sustainable market for a 24-hour black news channel?
Our demographic, African-Americans, they are more loyal. They buy more subscription television than any other demographic out there. They rely more on television for their news. There's some cultural things that's going on, some political things that's going on that's given news sort of a resurgence, if you will. When you look at the advertising dollars, you look at the money that's being spent trying to speak to certain people on those news shows, it's higher today than it was 10 years ago. I think that we're coming into the marketplace at an ideal time.
One of your top news executives, Gary Wardlaw, he said in one interview that the target audience for BNC is likely to be majority female. I can't help but notice that most of the top leadership, most of your executive team is male.
Of our four top management people, one of them is an African-American female. So that's 25%. You know, we've got to continue. When you look at what we are doing today and look at where we're at 12 months from now, we're probably going to look differently in our infrastructure and our programming and even our management teams.
So the obvious, you are a conservative. One of your high-profile hires, Larry Elder, is conservative. Is it your hope that this will be an outlet for more conservative views?
Not at all. We're not looking to be liberal or conservative. We want to provide a venue for African Americans to have a voice, to be a part of the dialogue that's going on in the country, be it incarceration reform or impeachment.
Just this week in his State of the Union, President Trump tried to appeal to African American voters, talking about increased funding for historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, about record low unemployment among African Americans. Have you thought about how BNC will handle coverage of President Trump, given that he drives so much of the news these days? But according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll, 8 in 10 African Americans view the president as racist. Do you see that as a challenge?
Well, it's a challenge for the administration. It's not a challenge for the news network. If, in fact, there's been increased funding for HBCUs, we have no problem reporting on that.
What about the other side of the school, the demeaning language directed at black people like Baltimore?
We'll be allowing the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, to tell their side of the story. We're not looking to be a mouthpiece for anybody, but we want to be a venue that if there are issues impacting the demographic that we serve, we want people to know about it. And if we can do that, I think we're going to be just fine.
That is J.C. Watts, co-founder and chairman of the Black News Channel, or BNC. It launches tomorrow. Mr. Watts, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has I guess you could say a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
35-year-old Matt Marshall runs a nonprofit. He serves on the school board. Through his group, the Washington 3%, he's challenging perceptions of the far-right militia movement. Or he was, until a domestic terrorism scandal became a test of his political ambitions. NPR's Hannah Alam has more from Washington State.
Okay, who's got the rent here?
Matt Marshall sits at a cafe in McKenna, a rural area outside of Seattle. It's the eve of a rally he's been planning for months. He writes last-minute notes in a book his daughter gave him for Christmas. In black marker on the cover, she's drawn the logo of the Washington 3%, her dad's militia. Except he doesn't like it when you call it that.
We're absolutely not paramilitary. We're a nonprofit corporation.
A nonprofit corporation, one that happens to be aligned with the Patriot Movement. That's a loose network of militias and self-described constitutionalist conservatives. They share the goal of limiting federal powers. Typically, they all get lumped together under one label, anti-government extremists.
The narrative is we're an all-white man, Christian Dominion-type, crazy, out-there far-right militia.
Marshall has been on a mission to change that image. First, he registered the Washington 3% as an independent nonprofit corporation. Next, he ran for the local school board. Instantly, headlines focused on the militia angle. Marshall was frustrated.
We're stuck in the middle. So the true neo-Nazis hate us, which they should, because we hate them too. And the far left, who we don't have any problem with, hate us because they believe that we're neo-Nazis.
But Marshall won that seat on the school board. The victory was bigger. It was a ticket into the mainstream. Maybe Matt Marshall could separate his group from the extremist fringe. Then came the other Matt. Matt Shea.
Inquiry finds state lawmaker engaged in domestic terrorism. That's a pretty memorable headline.
A report commissioned by Washington state lawmakers tied Representative Matt Shea to three armed standoffs with the government. He's also accused of advocating, quote, biblical warfare. Shea became a pariah to his party, and he lost his committee post. But he refuses to resign. Here he is last month speaking to supporters.
Seattle Times said that calling Matt Shea a domestic terrorist actually has made him more popular. I love that. And the fact is, they're trying to label us all domestic terrorists.
Matt Shea might not have many friends left at the Capitol, but he's got a friend in Matt Marshall, along with many other supporters linked to militias throughout the region. Marshall says the claims against Shea are sensationalized. He knows he's gambling with his political future by standing up for Shea. And he thinks it's a safe bet.
They can try to marginalize us as extremists all they want, but we're much more mainstream than they realize. And this is just proof that everybody is completely out of touch with the actual voters of the state.
They never miss a trick. They're always finding new venues and always finding new ways to present themselves.
David Neiwirth is a Seattle-based writer and researcher who spent years tracking the mainstreaming of far-right groups in the Pacific Northwest. He says he's not buying the militia makeover.
They can put the mask on for a while, but eventually it has to come off. And they always reveal who they are. I think that they often tell us who they are, and we just have to listen.
Rally time.
It's rally day. Busloads of supporters head into downtown Seattle to hear what Matt Marshall has to say. They know police and anti-fascist protesters are already at the site. A 3% member gives a quick safety briefing.
Well, no chit-chatting. Do not engage Antifa. Don't talk to them. Don't look at them. Watch your backs and stay as close as you can in a group.
As soon as the buses arrive, the protesters start to chant. Marshall steps up to the mic.
People want to know what the Washington 3% stands for politically. It's very simple. We aren't right, we aren't left.
He holds up a copy of the Constitution.
This is what we use. This is the Constitution of the United States.
Across the street, protesters try to drown him out.
The 3% has got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. The 3%.
But the only place Matt Marshall plans to go is to the Capitol. A few days after the rally, he announced his next big move. He's running to be a state lawmaker. Hannah Alam, NPR News, Seattle.
All right.
White supremacist propaganda is not just spreading across the country. It is growing, and it's hitting college campuses at alarming rates. This is according to a new report from the Anti-Defamation League. It tracked more than 2,700 cases last year, the most the organization has recorded in a single year. The material includes statements like "Reclaim America" and "One Nation Against Invasion." Oren Siegel is vice president of the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism and joins me. Thanks for coming and joining us on the program.
Good morning.
So just to clarify, when we say cases of propaganda, are we talking about things online or what exactly is the definition?
Specifically, we're talking about flyers, stickers, actual materials that are then posted either in the public square, on college campuses, sometimes on mosques or synagogues. So it's actually information that is delivered in real life.
So your report highlights a 120% jump last year from 2018 when it comes to this propaganda. What do you attribute this spike to?
Part of the spike is attributable to the fact that white supremacist events are actually down a bit, about 20 less than the previous year. White supremacists want to be able to amplify their message, glorify their hate, but some of them actually don't want to be seen or discovered. And so propaganda enables people to have a wide reach, create anxiety and fear in a community without necessarily having to put their actual face and name behind it.
This is interesting because, you know, we've talked about over the last few years, you know, some suggested there's been a growth in some of these groups. What over the last year would you say has caused people to want to sort of hide, not organize and use this kind of propaganda instead?
Well, again, I think there's more sort of bang for the buck. These are not, you know, flyers for piano lessons. These are flyers for hate, for narratives that underscore and motivate violent groups. And so there is a risk by being out there if you support that. It's also really cheap and easy. You know, 2,700 of these flyers doesn't mean that there's 2,700 individuals who did it, but it means that these groups are trying to show that they have a much broader reach, perhaps, than their numbers would suggest.
Hmm. So I'm struck that a quarter of this propaganda you found was distributed on college campuses. What do you make of that? I mean, is there evidence that these kinds of messages are attracting college students?
Well, you know, for the 630 incidents, we know that that occurred on 433 separate campuses. So in many cases, it was maybe one or two times on a campus, which suggests that there may be somebody who is not necessarily there. But here's the point of this propaganda. It's to create fear and anxiety in communities. It's to reach and maybe radicalize individuals. And it's the starting point of a broader movement's efforts. Just this past weekend in Washington, D.C., we saw 100-some-odd white supremacists associated with the group Patriot Front march in Washington, D.C. And Patriot Front is the group that is responsible for about 66% of these incidents. And so when we're looking at the impact of propaganda, whether it's in schools, whether it's in the public square, we need to remember that this is the narrative that starts in terms of outreach, but it can lead to much broader consequences.
All right. Oren Siegel is vice president of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Take care.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
After a series of deadly attacks targeting Latinos, Jews, and other minority groups in this country, the FBI has faced a pointed question. What more can authorities do to fight the spread of white supremacist violence? Now we have an answer.
We elevated to the top level priority racially motivated violent extremism, so it's on the same footing in terms of our national threat banding as ISIS and homegrown violent extremism.
That's FBI Director Christopher Wray at a hearing on Capitol Hill last week. For fiscal year 2020, he said the Bureau is putting racist violence on the same threat level as foreign terrorist groups. NPR's Hannah Alam covers extremism. She's here in the studio to talk more. Hey there.
Hi.
So did the FBI Director Wray actually say any specifics about how the Bureau plans to get tougher on racially motivated violence?
He did. And I mean, first off, just naming it as a priority sends a message and it signals that this is a top-down order. Wray made it a point to mention he'd gone in person to the crime scene at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh almost 2 years ago, the site of the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history. The FBI also launched a fusion group made up of agents working on both hate crimes and domestic terrorism. Wray called domestic terrorism and hate crimes, quote, close cousins. And so this is a merging of the criminal and the counterterrorism investigators. And then Wray also said we'd see changes in how the agency's 200 or so joint terrorism task forces, these are JTTFs, and they've really focused primarily on the Islamist extremist threat. And Wray said that those teams, we're talking 4,500 federal, state, local investigators, that they've been instructed to keep domestic terrorism, quote, squarely within their sights.
What do your sources tell you about how this has played out in actual cases so far?
Right. Well, federal agents tell you we've always been making these cases. And that's true. It's not a new category of threat. And to be clear, we are still talking about a fringe, but it's a fringe that's been seeping into the mainstream in some alarming ways. But yet it hasn't been typically treated as a national security issue. And in fact, it's been played down by the Trump administration, both in language and in funding priorities. So, yes, we are seeing a change in tone. And we're certainly hearing, you know, more from the FBI about these kinds of cases. You know, Exhibit A is the FBI's operation against the neo-Nazi group known as the Base. This is a group that wanted to trigger a race war. They were infiltrated, and authorities rounded up 7 suspected members in the past month on a variety of federal charges. And this was a case that Wray pointed to at the hearing. But he also stressed that the FBI investigates violence, not ideology. And just over the weekend, we saw 2 hate groups staging rallies in big American cities. In Portland, Oregon, a KKK faction backed out of their event at the last minute because some protesters showed up. But the Patriot Front was right here in Washington, D.C., marching on the National Mall in masks, chanting, "Reclaim America." So the FBI is signaling a crackdown on racially motivated extremism. But some of these groups are defiant and continue to dance right up to that line of what's protected speech.
Given what you said earlier about how this issue has been played down in the past in some ways, in language and in funding, how significant a step is this?
Like everything in Washington, it depends on who you ask. For many civil rights groups, members of Congress concerned about the rise in hate crimes, they'd say it's about time. You know, there's been a lot of criticism about, you know, has the government been nimble enough in responding to the changing threat picture? This picture, you know, the jihadist threat receding, at least here in the U.S., the far right coming to the forefront. And so, you know, some people say this isn't new as part of the restructuring that's been happening. And still others, especially former officials who worked on, you know, on these issues, say, sounds promising, but we want to see whether this kind of violence gets the staffing, the funding, and really the urgency that we saw with the fight against ISIS.
That's NPR's Hannah Lamb. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
New York. New York. New York.
A candidate who was not on the ballot in New Hampshire is 3 weeks away from a test. Michael Bloomberg entered the race late. He left the early states to Bernie Sanders, who won New Hampshire last night, or to Pete Buttigieg, who leads the Democratic delegate count after 2 states, or to Amy Klobuchar, who performed well in New Hampshire, or to other candidates who did not. Michael Bloomberg is not on the ballot anywhere until Super Tuesday in March, when many states vote. Bloomberg gave up the chance for attention in those early states, choosing instead to use some of his own fortune on overwhelming ad buys. But just as his moment arrives, he faces questions about his past. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson begins our coverage. Mara, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
How has New Hampshire sorted the Democratic field?
Well, it hasn't
sorted it very efficiently. If you're Michael Bloomberg and you're looking at what's coming at you, you see one front runner, Bernie Sanders. He's a strong front runner, not a prohibitive one, but he has dominated the left wing of the party. Then you see in the lane that Bloomberg is going to be competing in, you see a big muddle. The center left has not coalesced around a single alternative. That's what's good for Bloomberg. But you see the next big battle after these two lily white states are behind us. The battle is to put together the coalition that usually wins Democratic nominations, and that's African Americans and white liberals. And that's the big battle. Bernie Sanders has a gigantic organization. He has strength in labor unions. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, who came in second and third in New Hampshire, do not have that. Joe Biden is now trying to recover in South Carolina. So if you're Bernie Sanders, you say, I have a chance.
Does it seem clear to you that there is room for another candidate, given that several have done well in different ways?
Yes, I think there is room for another candidate just because the race is still so unsettled. And Mike Bloomberg, by spending, you know, over $250 million so far, has gotten himself into low double digits. So he is that other candidate.
Okay, Mara, thanks so much. That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Now, just as Bloomberg prepares for his possible moment, an old audio tape surfaced on social media. Not so old, really. It's from 2015. And it has Bloomberg defending part of his record as mayor of New York. Bloomberg supported a longstanding policy of stop and frisk, police searching people on the streets, especially in minority neighborhoods. Bloomberg has apologized for supporting that once upon a time. Michael Nutter is on the line. He is Michael Bloomberg's national political chairman for his campaign. Mayor Nutter, I call you mayor because you were mayor of Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. You know, you keep the title, but have no responsibility.
No responsibility, but you get it right. For life. You get it for
fantastic.
Life. I want to play some of this tape of Mayor Bloomberg from 2015. And it's not just that he's still defending stop and frisk in 2015. It's the way that he does it. Let's listen.
95% of your murders and murderers and murder victims fit one MO. You can just take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male minorities, 15 to 29. That's true in New York. It's true in virtually every city in America. And that's where the real crime is. You've got to get the guns out of the hands of those people to get killed.
It's hard to hear that, Mayor Nutter, so I'm going to repeat a couple of key phrases.
Yeah.
He's saying you can just take a description,
Xerox
it, pass it out to all the cops. The murders and murderers are, quote, male minorities, 16 to 25, true in virtually every city, and that's where the real crime is. What do you make of that, Mayor?
Well, first of all, I think, Steve, you know that that was actually an interview. I've read the full transcript. From that interview, there's actually another person involved. There was an interviewer, and so there's some back and forth. The tape sounds like they've taken whoever created the tape, took bits and pieces of Mayor Bloomberg's comments at that time and spliced them together.
Are you alleging that the thing we just heard did not happen in that order?
Oh, no. I think if you read the transcript, the actual readout from the transcript itself, what you will find is there's more colloquy, there's more back and forth between the mayor and the interviewer.
Okay,
nonetheless, the words are his.
Yeah.
It is him. I mean, as you said, it's slightly inaudible. But nevertheless, if you walk through the pieces of what the mayor said, it is an unfortunate truth and reality that in many cities, and certainly would be the case in Philadelphia, the vast majority of perpetrators and victims, unfortunately, are often Black or Latino males, usually between the ages of about 16-25, 16-27, overwhelmingly either Black or Latino perpetrators and victims.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way Mayor Mike conveys that information, could have been better, more empathetic, and with more context to what's going on. But if you look at the data, if you look at the actual information, whether in New York or Philadelphia and many other cities, it is an unfortunate reality that much of what he said is in fact true. And
You're saying that what is true is that people of color live in neighborhoods that have higher crime rates, and we could talk about all the social reasons that that might be, or why the police would find more crime or go looking for more crime in those particular neighborhoods. But let's talk about the context in which Bloomberg would have been making that statement, Mayor Nutter. Mm-hmm. He's talking about this policy of stop and frisk, of police stopping people on the streets of New York, in his case, or in many other cities.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening there is not that police are looking at statistics and finding the race of particular murderers in the past. They are drawing conclusions about the individual in front of them based on their race. That was the criticism of stop and frisk.
Right. And that is a criticism of stop and frisk, because if you utilize that constitutionally allowed tactic or strategy properly, you have to have an articulable reason to stop an individual. You have to have a reasonable suspicion that the person either has or is about to commit a crime,
mm-hmm.
and that you have an additional reason to think the person may present a danger to the community or to yourself as a police officer.
It seems not to have always been used under those limited ways, right?
Say that again?
It seems not always to have been used within those limitations.
Exactly.
Am I correct?
And therein lies the problem, that some of the officers, I'm not going to paint with a broad brush, but that some of the officers took shortcuts. Some of the officers may have used the allowable tactic beyond what the standards are, and created an environment where the relationship between the community and the police was totally disrupted, completely offensive, and damaged the kind of interaction that citizens have with police officers. People want to be safe, but they don't want to be abused. And that was, as Micah said numerous times, and that was his failure in recognizing that while crime is going down, a good thing, bad things were happening out on the streets of New York,
mm-hmm.
And he, as a leader, has taken responsibility for that.
The effort was
always about public safety, but unfortunately, in the pursuit of public safety, some bad things were happening, and Mike failed to see that, realize that, understand that early enough.
Let me just ask if he's apologized. Well, he has apologized. We should acknowledge that, and he apologized again yesterday after this tape recirculated. But I want to ask about one part of this, Mayor. When he was first running for president, he's asked by mm-hmm. Gail King of CBS about this policy, and he says, "Nobody asked me about this until I ran for president," suggesting it mm-hmm. was never controversial in the past. That's just an obviously false statement. It was very controversial during his time as mayor. In fact, he backed off the policy while he was mayor. Why did he make that false statement?
So I wasn't in the interview. I don't know the context of the back and forth between them. And quite honestly, it's never been clear to me if he completely understood the question, the way that Gail was asking it. I don't know whether he was saying no one asked him at the time or no one has asked him recently.
But you would agree it was a matter of much debate at the time, right? While he was mayor, there were other opinions. It wasn't an uncontroversial policy at the time.
I mean, I'm certainly aware that there were, I mean, you know, I was doing my job in Philadelphia at the time, but, you know, there were certainly, as I recall, protests in New York. I mean, you know, I didn't follow New York activities on a day-to-day basis, but certainly there were people protesting. There was a lot of activity in New York, and the same was going on in Philadelphia and other places. So, I mean, maybe it was a misstatement. Maybe there was, you know, some back and forth that he didn't completely understand. I wasn't in the interview, so,
gotcha.
I mean, it's kind of hard for me to
understand.
You know,
let me ask about one other thing
in
the minute that we have, Mayor Nutter. Michael Bloomberg has made an active effort not just to apologize, but to appeal to black voters. What is he trying to say to African Americans and other people of color? What is his message to them now?
I think the message is, you know, somewhat similar to what his message was as mayor of New York. First and foremost, people want to be safe, and the responsibility of any government, local, state, or federal, is to make sure that people are safe. But beyond that, and recognizing some of the damage that was contributed to in New York, and now he's running for president of the United States. So you look at the Greenwood Initiative and the speech that Mike made in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's talking about tripling black wealth. He's talking about 100,000 new black-owned businesses with employees, 1 million new African-American homeowners, which, of course, home ownership helps to build wealth and generational wealth. And so Mike is running for president now. He's not running for mayor of New York. It's a different kind of job, a different position, and is making clear to the African-American community and the Hispanic and Latino community that not only does he get it, but that he can use the power of being president of the United States of America to heal some of the wounds and make things better for people.
Okay, Michael Nutter, former mayor of Philadelphia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Okay, pick a number. How many confirmed cases of coronavirus are there in New York City? You get 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. No, I wasn't just counting down. That's the answer to the question. Zero cases of coronavirus confirmed in New York City. But that has not prevented an uptick in fear and misinformation aimed at local Asian communities. There are also business impacts to even the fear of coronavirus. And people are also having to deal, especially in the Chinese American community, with the threat of spread. A couple of viral videos reported by Gothamist last week have raised the alarm about xenophobic and anti-Asian incidents being fueled as a result of news surrounding the virus. In one video, an apparent Asian woman is seen attacking another subway rider after he allegedly attacked her, calling her a diseased B-word in the process. A second video shows an Asian male being told, "Oh, this is why you have an effing virus. Keep picking through the garbage, you effing idiot," as the gentleman was collecting cans from garbage bags in Manhattan. Meanwhile, yesterday, China recorded the most deaths from the virus in a single day. The new daily death toll record of 97 was set. Since the new virus was first detected in December, the death toll has reached 908. And the number of confirmed infections is now more than 40,000. As of last Thursday, though, there were just 12 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the United States, and again, zero in New York City. With us now, Joanne Yu, Executive Director of the Asian American Federation. She's here to talk about the anti-Asian backlash, how local Asian communities are dealing with that, and the virus itself, and also how it's affecting businesses in the city, which many of you heard did come up just there in Richard's newscast. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
So we just marked the end of the two-week Lunar New Year celebration. I don't have to tell you. How would you characterize this year's celebration compared to others, with the threat of the virus for one thing and the backlash as another in the backdrop?
Absolutely. I think when the threat happened, it was announced, I think we were all really fearful, obviously. Lunar New Year is a great time of celebration, not just for the Chinese community, but for many Asian American communities. And because there are these amazing immigrant, Asian American immigrant enclaves, that's where we tend to flock to. So when the scare happened, you know, we were all really nervous. We were really sad. And we know that the feeling is still lingering. I think a lot of the small business owners certainly are very, very anxious. We're seeing less people on the sidewalks coming to visit, less people visiting, going to the restaurants, at a time when we really should have just robust customers and foot traffic all over the Flushing, Brooklyn, and Chinatown.
Right. Terrible timing that it came right as Lunar New Year was hitting with all the tourism that brings and the extra business, right?
Absolutely.
What about Chinese New Yorkers themselves? Also fearful in staying away from crowds?
I think what the Asian American community, the Chinese community, what they're fearful of is the racism that we're seeing, we're encountering. There's a lot of just this, you know, just comments that we're hearing. And it's not just the East Asian community that we're hearing. It's even my own staff, you know, very diverse, ethnically diverse staff. And you know, we sort of joke that we're afraid to cough on the train because people are looking at us funny. And so I think there's just a lot of, and, you know, people look at you funny. They do make racist comments under their breaths. We've heard it before. I'm afraid to clear my throat in public.
Yeah,
so this is the reality that we're living through.
And we had an interview on the station with a high school girl who's Asian American the other day. I don't even think she was coughing on anybody, but she said her classmates were starting to shun her.
Absolutely. We are going to see every time something like this happens, you know, whether it be Ebola or SARS, the immigrant community braces itself for the impact because for some reason, you know, we are supposed to, you know, acquire this virus through DNA. I mean, many of us have never been to Wuhan, and so we're not really sure why all of a sudden everybody is so fearful. There's globalization. I think everybody travels for work, for pleasure, and I think there's a lot of tourists that come. How do we know that it's not the non-Asian tourists who might be infected and who bring it to New York? So I think there's just a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of panic, but it's also a really scary time because obviously xenophobia and racism, it's on the rise.
I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy.
Thanks, Daniel. Happening today, the man accused of setting three historically black churches on fire is expected to change his plea in federal court. Holden Matthews originally pleaded not guilty to charges stemming from the three St. Landry Parish fires.
But according to court records, plea negotiations have been ongoing in the case. Matthews also faces state charges in connection with those arsons. Abby Breidenbach is live with more details about today's hearing and a timeline of this case.
From the morning of the first church fires last March, we've been closely following and reporting on the tragedies, the investigations, as well as the court dates. Here's a look at everything leading up to this point. March 26, 2019, St. Landry Fire District 2 responded to a fire at St. Mary Baptist Church in Port Barry. This predominantly black church was founded in the 1800s and well established in the Port Barry community. On April 2nd, the second reported at the Greater Union Baptist Church, 742 in Opelousas. This build held almost 130 years of history. The large majority of African Americans. The third and final fire was reported 2 days later at the Mount Pleasant Baptist Church on Highway 182 in Opelousas. The blaze burned from the early hours of the morning through mid-afternoon, charring 140 years of tradition in a rural part of the parish. By the end of this 10-day stretch, the story gained national attention, drawing the FBI into the investigations. Due to evidence on surveillance video and a gas can left on one of the properties, on April 10th, investigators identified 21-year-old Holden Matthews as a suspect in all three fires. Within 12 hours, he was in police custody. Matthews, the son of a St. Landry Parish Sheriff's Office deputy, did not resist arrest. He remains a federal inmate at Lafayette Parish Jail. Holden Matthews was indicted on 6 charges this June 6th. Now, 3 of those charges are using fire to commit a felony, and the other 3 damaging religious property intentionally. Now, those last 3 are considered hate crimes. The trial date was set and then continued to this morning. That trial is now off the schedule, and Matthews is just scheduled for a change of plea hearing. That means he's likely to change his plea from not guilty to guilty this morning. Now, even with a plea deal, he will still face state charges. We'll continue to keep you updated on this developing story. Live in Lafayette, Abby Breidenbach. Good morning, Acadiana.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 15, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions you would like to offer. The number to dial, 605-313-5164, the code 564 #943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share before we get to the listeners. Number one, Counter Racist Yoga Retreat, May 21 through May 24. We are coming to Toronto. Plant-based meals, yoga every day. Maybe we can go to the gun range, maybe not. We'll have to see. Counter-racist workshops, food workshops on how to prepare some of the spectacular food that we will devour while visiting Toronto. A little over half of the slots have been filled. We're at about a little over half capacity. If you would like to join us, feel free. The total price is $660 U.S. To register, the deadline is February 29th, and all you need, an investment of $400 by February 29th. That will secure your spot, non-refundable $400 deposit. The remaining $260 due by May 1st. That includes all meals, lodging, yoga. Looking forward to a spectacular time in Toronto for the spring. Wow. If you have questions, need additional information, everything is shared on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Half price for children between the ages of or under 14. Half price for children under the ages of 14. Drop an email if you need or if you have questions, need more details, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Excited. Looking forward to Toronto in the spring. Next, we are listener-supported Counter Racist Radio Invest. If you think the program is constructive, visit the blog, previously mentioned, racism-notes.blogspot.com. The address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Also on Cash App, for the folks who are not into PayPal, Cash App, the address is cash.app/$TheCows. Enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have supported us, Cash App, PayPal, over the years. Certainly if you're not into all of the newfangled financial technology, you can drop an email. We can get you a physical mailing address. Also, my wish list is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Enormous gratitude to all the listeners who have grabbed items over the past 11 years. Hopefully the child has been continued to be worthy of your time and energy. Really love my spice jars that I got this week. Wow, spent the last couple of days getting all of my wonderful spices gathered, organized, all of the professional labels, turmeric, curry, garlic. Absolutely love it. Didn't even know I was the type of person who would need or enjoy such a gift, but I do cook quite a bit more these days, being vegan. Speaking of vegan, just checking in on the foods. Again, we do this when Dr. Lipton is on the program, but folks who dial in to share, not be spectators, share at least one thing that you ate for the day. That would be great. Just checking in. What you eat is super important. We want to make sure we have all the vitality necessary to go about the business of solving the problem. I don't think eating a lot of potato chips and Slurpees and Cheetos and Tahitian treats, I don't think that any of that is going to help fuel our brain computer to function optimally so that we can go about the business of solving the problem. Let's see, I had, not going to be a hypocrite, I had smoothie for breakfast with vegetables, fruits. Let's see, it had oat milk, beets. I love beets. I really miss pomegranates. I've had pomegranates in my smoothie since September. This is the first time that I've enjoyed pomegranates like daily for the duration of their season. I didn't even know pomegranate season when that was until, you know, a few months back. It's September to like January in California when they grow about other parts of the planet. But I absolutely love them. Well, that'll be at least one thing I can look forward to for the fall, the return of fresh pomegranates. But in lieu of those, I had oat milk, banana, let's see, fresh ginger, fresh turmeric, spinach, blueberries, acai puree, dates, love dates. Wow, love fresh dates. Peanut butter, apple, pear, orange with the peel, kumquat. Anything else? I think that might be it. It was amazing. Missed the pomegranates, but it was amazing. I cooked. I had, you only have to share one thing, but I cooked. I don't know if I would make this at the retreat, but it was very good. I had peanut tofu curry with coconut rice. I added. You bake the tofu so it gets nice and crisp, and then you have like a peanut butter-based, coconut milk-based curry sauce, and you add the tofu to that, and I added snow peas, mushrooms, spinach, and broccoli so I could get a nice collection of vegetables. Wow. It was my first time making it. I'd make it a little bit spicier. That's about the only thing. I'm going to add a little bit of spice, maybe some peppers or some cayenne, something to make it a little spicier. And it was pretty dull. I was almost going to take a picture, but I was hungry and was ready to eat as opposed to doing a photo shoot. But eating quality foods that nourish your body. Lasting impact, be mindful. I think in that, at least it's been my experience with me, you start being mindful about what you put in your mouth, you start to become a lot more mindful about many other things, what you say. Lots of things. Words are important. Let's see, continuing. So many things to share. I guess I'll get in my prompt now since I just talked about words. They mentioned in the report the term was used, lily white. I'm only going to read from the word guide one time, even though there are probably lots of reasons. This will be my one. I'm very certain that lily white is in the word guide. Let's see. Bang, there it is, page 208. Lily white. Do not use this term. When speaking or writing about any person or any place, do not describe them as being lily white. When speaking or writing about people in regards to color and or non-color, use the terms white, non-white, and or white supremacist, racist. Study the way that others use the term lily white, particularly when they apply it to people. Note, during the existence of white supremacy racism, the term Lily White has often been used to imply that a white person is not only white in appearance, but also clean, pretty, beautiful, pure, unspoiled, and or in other ways, non-contaminated by any person or thing that is dark in appearance or in so-called essence. Lily White. Again, the recommendation not to use that term on this broadcast. Try to point out regularly. Metaphors are important. They are invoked regularly. They got cream of the crop will be one. I don't think that was used in any of the segments this week, but lots of them reinforce white supremacy, racism, white being pure, perfect, unblemished by niggers, that's way of thinking, beautiful, everything that he just laid out in the code book. Lots of the metaphors enforce that with the use of colors. Also, many of the metaphors, particularly when racists are using analogies, comparisons between two separate entities, they will insist that these two entities are exactly alike. They are identical when they make their comparisons and such. Frequently, this is master deception, white supremacy, racism. Victims of racism, we do this too. We have been exposed to this misconduct for a long time, and many of us are still learning, myself included. Often, when we don't have logic or evidence to articulate our views, we'll substitute with an analogy, metaphor of some sort, and often that just produces more confusion. If we can work to be direct, precise, exact with our word choice, that would be appreciated. If you need more time to gather your thoughts, that is always encouraged and applauded. I will prompt about the metaphors. Words, very important. I did get, I just want to get this in as well. I did see a few times this week people kind of weaved Black History Month together with so-called Valentine's Day, which was yesterday, February 14th. And I saw someone sending Dr. King a Valentine's, and then you just heard Valentine's for Congressman John Lewis. And it's just, I mean, certainly VGQ to, you know, any non-white person, if you celebrate so-called Valentine's Day or any other holidays, ones that you make up or the already established days, just in my view, if we are going to recognize a victim of white supremacy, I'll give you an example personally. I used to call Rosa Parks. I'd say, wow, Rosa Parks is a gangster. And what I would mean, that's supposed to be like a term of endearment because she was so consistent throughout her life and working for the Scottsboro Boys. This is in the 30s and working to help black people who had been raped and, you know, black people who had been thrown in jail incorrectly, victims of racism, all the things that she had been doing for years and years and years and then carrying on for years afterwards and being terrorized and just very impressive person. And I stopped and I said, man, I don't think Mrs. Parks would appreciate me calling her a gangster. We'll have to find a better term. Words are important. And with Valentine's Day, I just feel like that's such a contrived racist holiday. I mean, they all are so-called holidays, but I mean, if you want to talk about the most artificial in a system of total terrorism, we go around and tax black people who shouldn't be paying taxes and take their house and kick them out on the street and then stop and say, whoa, let me dig in my pocket and give you a chocolate heart, maybe with peanuts, because it's Valentine's Day and I love you. We just had the report yesterday. They were talking about the number of marriages that end in divorce. What are you talking about? They might as well have a day that it'd be more accurate to stop and have a purge day on the 14th where you hand out, you know, brass knuckles and you can all go out and fight and scrap. That would be more accurate, reflective of what we have, as opposed to pretending that there is some love going on, whatever that, you know, means. But anyway, it would not be Happy Valentine's Day as I recognize, you know, a victim of racism who's done well to try as they can to produce justice. It just seems Dr. King was upset about capitalism. It's just, I thought that, anyway, maybe I'm incorrect. Woo! Okaldokal. So people, I think, or maybe some of the folks who were with us, I guess last month, maybe a few weeks back, I read a report. There was a listener who was not pleased with my commentary questions during the broadcast with Michelle Cassandra Johnson. She thought that I may have displayed some hatred for black females in my questions, commentary about her book, Skill in Action. I read her email unedited and gave my reply. And I think I mentioned during that segment that I rolled out of bed and checked my email, and that was what I saw. This morning, I got out of bed. I rolled over to check my email. This was the first email that I saw. Greetings. I appreciate your work and radio program, The Cows, and have gained so much. Oh, wait a minute. This is the wrong email. You can delete all of that. Here we go. Correct email. Carceral rhetoric is the subject. I'm noticing a disturbing pattern of rhetoric from both the host and most of the callers. White females are always referred to as white women. Black women are always referred to as black females. Female disregards the adult status of black women, has women in all capital letters, yet it's always offered to describe white females. It's negging, N-E-G-G-I-N-G, carceral rhetoric, and it needs to stop. The host should be way more aware than he is, considering the subject he is covering. He's playing just as much into white supremacy by denying black women the definition of women. Again, women, all capital letters. White females, if you're going to call adult black women females, but black women who have reached the age of majority, but black, or that's supposed to be black, but black women who have reached the age of majority are called women. Again, all capitals. Thank you, caller. Same thing I said to the last caller. If you have concluded that Gus T hates black females or is sexist against black females or has some sort of dislike, disregard towards black females, please find another program. Now, this I found interesting because I would think the same person who said, I hear the callers and the hosts consistently, it's black females and white women. If you've listened that much to notice a pattern, I would think that you have also heard black male, white men. And that's what I wrote in reply, in my response. I would hope that you observe the same symmetry in the dialogue of both the host and the callers. And I hope that that has been consistent for 11 years, not that you have to have listened that long to come to, you know, an analysis or try to pick out a pattern. There is a reason for that, and it's exactly what you said. The adult status of black women in a system of racism, white supremacy, just using counter-racist logic, and you don't have to agree, VGQ. However, in a system of racism, white supremacy, you cannot, according to what I have concluded, you cannot qualify to be a man or a woman if you are subject to the system of racism. If that is the case, no one classified as non-white would qualify as a man or a woman. And in fact, I think I just said this last month when I read the previous email. I just said this. No problem saying it again because I do have a question attached to all of this. I have noted a pattern about all of this, but there is a reason, and it's symmetrical. I don't think anyone has reported hearing black female, black man. That's not done on the program. It's black male, black female. Nobody is qualified as things stand currently for man, woman, unless you're classified as white. That's what we are trying to correct. Universal man, universal woman. That is the goal. The pattern that I have noted on this here broadcast is that there have been a number of males and females, non-white, who have gotten upset or noted their displeasure with the use of the term female. No one has ever, ever, ever had any problem, qualm about male being used to describe black males. But black female, oh yeah, in fact, it's in the archives. You can go back and listen. We were doing the program on the Albany Three in New York. This is the black females. They were terrorized on the bus full of drunk white people on a weekend. They were college students. They cursed at them. It ended up being a confrontation and totally caused them all these problems in their college career. We were talking about all of this with some of the filmmakers. There's a documentary about their position. We talked about all this in the archives. But I was same thing I've been doing for 11 years. So these young ladies, black females, they went through. And the guest took a moment. This was a black male. Paused. It took a moment to chastise me and explain that she should not be using that term. It demeans black females and they're black women. It takes away their status as women and all the rest of it. And I said the same thing on that program. I've had people email in and interrupt the live program to do all that. No one has ever said that about the word male, nor have they said, well, I do hear you using the term male. So at least it seems that there's some symmetry and consistency. But they don't even say that. Just skip over the male part totally. I'm just pointing that out as, wow, it's so quick to get to that. Man, you hate black females. And you hate black, you're just a sexist. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Hold on. Yes, I was going to call her a hussy if you'd given me, you know, five more seconds. But I say black male and black female all the time. You don't have to say black male and black female, but there is a logical reason and there is symmetry, consistency. If folks have a theory, a reason as to why males and females have a problem with the use of the term black female, feel free to share. Then maybe we can have a codified response to that other than just pointing them to Mr. Fuller's book and telling them to read that page, which has been done before. Anywho, the main message, if you think Gustie hates black females, find another program. With that, if you take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, suggestions, that would be grand. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be spectacular. Just preserve the audio quality of the program. You can find a quiet location, share your thoughts, views, and mute your line. If you have additional thoughts to share, fine. Just wait till everyone has spoken at least once, and then you can unmute and share again. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. And actually, before I depart, she used the term negging because she thought there was an agenda, I guess, or suspected that there could be. She used the term negging about the use of the term black female. Negging is an act of emotional manipulation whereby a person makes a deliberate backhanded compliment or otherwise flirtatious remark to another person to undermine their confidence and increase their need of the manipulator's approval. Wow. Well, if you have concluded that's what's happening, or that's why I'm using the term female, you can see what I said previously two times. Another program. Okay, one more email from a listener who wrote in, reading is more important than watching television. Investor, he wrote, listening to the February 14 Workplace Racism podcast yesterday, one of the callers discussed a presentation about MLK Jr. It was posited that he was named after Martin Luther, the German religious figure. I remember from the book club reading that Coretta Scott King mentioned that this is a common misconception. Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King, was named after two of his father, James's brothers. MLK Jr. was named after his father. There are some interesting additional details regarding both of their names, But the bottom line is that according to Coretta Scott King, there's no connection between Martin Luther King Jr.'s name and Martin Luther. We read, "My Life, My Love, My Legacy," Coretta Scott King, in the archives. And in fact, page 41 to 42, he even had the page number. "I had done my homework on the Kings." This is Coretta Scott King, the late. "And over the years, I would continue filling in the missing pieces. Daddy King was the second of 10 children born to sharecroppers James and Delia King in 1899 on a plantation called Stockbridge, a few miles outside Atlanta. At first, I thought that since Martin hailed from a great line of preachers, someone in the family must have had the forethought to name him after the great German theologian Martin Luther, but that was not the case. As a boy, Martin Sr. was actually called Mike because of his mother's insistence that she had named him after Michael, the archangel. With the same intensity, his father James insisted that he be named Martin Luther after two of his brothers. Since it was uncommon for blacks to have birth certificates, racism, which could have settled the issue, as a compromise, he was always called Mike. At the request of his dying father, Mike took out the necessary legal papers to have his name changed, as well as the name of his firstborn, Martin Luther King Jr., who was also called Mike. From then on, he was officially Martin Luther King Sr., or within the family, Daddy King." We did just talk about this yesterday, workplace racism. And I think the way that I phrased my response was because I had totally forgotten about this victim. But I said that is common. I'm not saying it's true, but that is presented commonly. And I think the listener who presented it even had a suspicion, like, I wonder, is that true? Because people just make things up about black people all the time, and that might not even be true. And reading is more important than watching television. Much obliged. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks with a hand up, again, one thing. You don't have to give your whole menu. So if you had Cheetos and Funyuns and the rest of it, you know, as long as you had a banana at some point, I did get a banana. Everything wasn't perfect. I did get some fruit. I'm going to do better tomorrow. That works. But at least one thing that you ate for the day. Star 61, if you would like to chime in. First few folks with a hand up should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus, to the callers and just listeners. This is a female, a black female from New York, living in South Carolina now. And to the person who did the research on the name of my ancestor, Martin Luther King, I do appreciate it. And my suspicions were correct. And there are many, many of these cartoons and these lies that are told to elementary school children about history every day. I see them all the time, not only during Black History Month. So it's a part of the programming. I do appreciate that, and I may just if it comes up again, you know, in my career, I may just politely see if I can make a correction, you know, in the form of a question maybe, you know, are we sure that that's true? You know, I think I heard somewhere that he was named after his brothers, after his uncles, and, you know, so I do appreciate that quite a bit. And one thing I had today, okay, so I had to go to a luncheon today, and you know how these things go, the fried chicken, I don't know, fried chicken and rolls and all these things. So I knew I had to stay away from the fried chicken for the cholesterol purposes, but they did have a yummy, yummy salad, a regular old garden salad. I am not crazy about iceberg lettuce. and it was made with iceberg lettuce, because I was told many, many years ago that that's like one of the worst lettuces that you can eat is iceberg lettuce. But I don't know, maybe I'll check with Dr. Ruby on that. And so I picked out, like, it has tons of spinach in it. So I picked out the spinach and the tomatoes and the cucumbers, which I absolutely love. And that's all I'll talk about. That's my one thing. Okay. Thank you for listening. Gus, you can mute my line. I'm on this free conference call thing with this screen. I don't know how to do it.
Much obliged. We talked about that just yesterday. That's the sort of thing I would go directly to Coretta Scott King, like, whammo. I didn't, hear about this on Wikipedia, and, you know, this is not my cousin who dropped out of the eighth grade. Like, Coretta Scott King, whammo. Like, I would have the picture right there, and this is totally false. Like, every time, totally false, and dare somebody, well, that Coretta Scott King, she don't know what she's talking about. That's, you know. Might as well get on Wikipedia or pick anything. You know, listen to what she has to say about her husband being named after his brothers. You know he was named. Okay, no problem. No problem. But reading, more important than watching television. I'm so glad our listener, investor, I'm so glad his memory is better than mine. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, suggestions to offer, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and to the family, the callers and listeners. My wife, I just wanted to put this real quick in. My wife, she makes me drink this like 3 times a week, and what we do is you get the red beet bulb, you get the red beet, and they're not easy to cut, and they stain everything, but the red beet, and you get a cucumber, and this is like this is a two juice, like a juice. It's a cleanse. You get the red beet, you get a cucumber, put an apple in for flavor, turmeric, grind a little ginger on the cheese grater, grind your ginger root on it. And when you juice that, I know I'm missing something, but a little olive oil, some virgin olive oil, and then I'm sure I'm missing something else. But that's a great, it's a cleanse. And don't be surprised when it comes out the other end. Yes, it's gonna be like beet red, but that's okay. It's clean. It's pulling. And I just wanted to add that to the health section, because I know you about your health. And I'm not going to call you brother. You're not my brother. You've made it clear that you're not my brother. You've made it clear that I'm not your brother. And the clips that you were playing basically was like, wow, like these people that are talking about making America great again. Each one of these people, these white people, I'm not talking about copper colored people, but the white people, if you ask them, these red blooded Americans, is what they, I don't know what they call them. I know I'm not supposed to use metaphors, but these white people in this country, if you ask them, you know, where are your people from, they will proudly say, you know, I'm from, you know, I'm German, or I'm Scottish, or I'm Irish, or wherever they come from, they will proudly tell you that. So why is it, Gus, that we allow these people to come here and tell us that, you know, this is their land, and this is, you know, we're going to make our land great, and when these people are just, they're bastards to the land. I mean, I'm not being belligerent. I'm just being honest. But I want to know what your proposal is to fix this. It's not white supremacy. I believe it's white insanity. And it's, we are allowing these people to indoctrinate us and let us, allow us to follow their lead. What is your proposal on fixing this this problem?
Well, one, I will go to that word allow, very important. Words are important on this program. Victims guarantee qualified. People don't have to use the words that I use in describing this problem. But that word allow gets used frequently. I was going to use a metaphor. I will not. Well, actually, it's not a metaphor. We are in a prison, so I can use it, thankfully. So if we were talking about greater confinement, we wouldn't be using the language allow. We wouldn't be saying that Mumia Abu-Jamal allows the guards to keep him in greater confinement, or at least I don't think that that's logical. He is in a weak position, sickly, has been the case for quite some time. I think he was shot the day that he was shackled and placed in greater confinement. So it's not a question of allow. If you are in a position of domination, you are subject to someone who has overwhelming force on their side against you. It would be that you are subject to. That would be it, and you have not figured out a way, as you said, to solve the problem. If you have a proposal, it's not accurate, or you haven't figured out a way to implement. In short, you have not figured out a way to solve the problem. No one has, obviously, because the system is still here. Now, specifically, one of the things that I suggest, because I don't have a solution because the problem is still here. I have suggestions about things that I think would be helpful towards that end. One of them is being more mindful, more aware about what we eat. That Clint, he mentioned a lot of the same things that I mentioned in my smoothie, the turmeric, the ginger, the apple. I like zucchini in my smoothie. He said cucumber, but that's, you know, right there, cousins, literally. But a lot of the same things, eating healthy, phenomenal. With the allow, I think that is important in terms of being mindful what we say, because that tends to, it's victim blaming. It's suggesting that I have the ability to do something about this, and I am allowing this to take place, when I am saying that is not the case. This problem can be solved, but this is not something where black people are just allowing white people to lead them, or this is a case. So I said words are important. You said it's white insanity. Victims guaranteed qualified. You can, you know, describe this in whatever way you think is logical and accurate. In my view, we're talking about a global system of people. They describe themselves as white. They are dedicated to dominating and abusing individuals they say are not white. That is not insanity. That is someone who scientifically, Dr. Kanban, scientifically plots methodically, which you heard, how are we going to take these niggas' property in Detroit? That's not insanity. If I sit down at a table calmly with a pen and pad or my phone maybe and say, well, let's sit down and think of how we're going to take these niggers' property. It's 80% black in Detroit. How are we going to do this? Oh, property tax. Well, if you're really, really poor, and we know we've made them really, really poor, you're not supposed to pay property taxes. Oh, wait a minute. We're white supremacists. But it's not insane. We're white supremacists. The black people don't tell us what the property tax is going to be. We tell them what the property tax is going to be, and they might not even find out until, you know, 10, 15 years later. We say all the time, you get accurate information at the time that you need it. That's not allowing. Black people are not in a position where they just allow themselves to be ignorant all the time. That's not allow. That's deliberate. When white people hide, Carl Andrews, guest on the program, talked about that, where white people make it difficult to find those tax records. You might not even realize until 15 years later, house is already gone, you're destitute, and then it's, oh, man, I wasn't even supposed to be paying taxes, and they did this to me. That's what domination looks like. You try to do the best you can to understand what that is, because I've been saying that the whole time we've been reading Harriet A. Washington. Most black people don't have a clue about what this is, the gravity of it, the totality of it. We don't describe it in an accurate manner. You try your best you can to use words in an accurate manner to describe this problem. In my view, you have accurate words, accurate thinking that will push you towards an accurate solution to the problem. The vast majority of victims of racism do not speak accurately about this problem.
Okay.
You have 30 seconds if you have a follow-up.
30 seconds. Yes, sir. 30 seconds. Thank you for answering my question, Mr. Gus. However, there are as many black people as well as white people, that are perpetuating and allowing this system to take place. And we are allowing it to happen because we keep participating. And that's why we do allow, and I'm going to keep saying that word, I know I got 15 seconds, allowing them, because we keep falling for their system. We keep participating in the system. So therefore, we do allow it to happen. And forgive me if you don't agree, but thank you for taking my call.
Oh, that's great. Awesome. Thank you.
Peace and love.
Victims guaranteed, qualified, and I don't need a response, or you can think about it, and this way you can do it. You can think about it, and then perhaps you can call in next week or the next time you dial in, if you so choose. What should be done? If that's the issue, since we, and if it's, you know, allow and participate, I don't know any non-white person in the known universe who is not participating in the system of white supremacy. So, what should be done with, to, about any non-white person who is participating in any way, shape, form with the system of racism? What should be done with them? And the person you can start with is you, because you know you are participating too. So, you can call in the next time and let us know what should be done, and we'll, you know, evaluate that solution and see if it's logical. Because that'll be something that'll apply to everybody, since we're all participating. So we'll be waiting anxiously and hope it's not something that's too punitive. Anywho, other folks who dialed in, VGQ again is victims guaranteed qualified. We are not looking for consensus following logic, because we are not going to come to the same conclusion about this problem for a variety of reasons. Not needed. Just follow logic. Number again is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That's what they said in Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste. You niggers, it's your fault. You allowed the lead to come in and poison everything. It's your fault. You here. Let's get some spick and span in you. Reading is more important than watching television. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments to share, questions, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. A couple of days ago, I was informed by an associate, counter-racist associate, and attended a viewing of a six-seven part series on the murder of Malcolm X. The individual, I think I brought it up on the program, the individual who was featured in this seven-hour documentary, although they didn't show all 7 hours. He was in attendance at the meeting at Florida Memorial University. That's the person that I suggested for a future interview. Should be interesting. Earlier this week, also, I was visiting a fellow retiree from the fire department that was involved in an automobile accident. He broke his neck. On the way going to Jackson Memorial Hospital, you remember I mentioned about that, I think, yesterday, there's a lot of quote-unquote homeless people who venture in the area. Out of the shadows, shouldn't say that's a metaphor. Out of a corner, a white male came out and stated and asked me for some money. And my counter-racist code of codified reaction was, no, I don't give money to white people. He got exceedingly angry, did some cursing. I was still walking. I said what I had to say. My associate actually stopped and was about to get involved with a conversation, but I basically alerted him to keep pushing. I said what I said, and I think I was codified on my response to him asking me for money, and we moved on. DCS program today was canceled because of a mishap with the suits for the young fellas, and it would carry on next week. I've always, for a very long time, as I've been progressing on having a better understanding of the global system of racism, white supremacy, to not identify myself as a man, not identify black females as women. From a logical standpoint, you can't be a man and woman and be a victim of racism, white supremacy at the same time. You're either one or the other. That's logic. And that's all I have to say. Thanks for listening.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter. Following logic. Following logic. Love it. Hopefully we'll get the update DCS program next week and move it forward. Other folks, if we have missed you totally, if you have questions, comments, suggestions, theories about what sparks turmoil with the term black female, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Henry in Chicago.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The only healthy thing I had was water today, so I ate very bad. the clip with the Detroit area where they were getting property taxes raised unnecessarily kind of reminds me of what happened here in the Chicagoland area 2 years ago with the Cook County assessors raising property taxes on lower income, majority non-white black areas where black people live at, assessing them at higher rates than areas where they, you know, quote unquote, say that, you know, higher income people, aka white people, live at. But what was interesting is the Chicago Sun-Times had reported this plan by white supremacists to raise property taxes on lower income, aka black people, area. But it wasn't until four white people started to complain about it, which is when the media or the Chicago Sun-Times got involved, because, you know, we've kind of known about this for a while as far as non-white black people, but it didn't become prevalent until a white lady, she was in the newspaper when the story broke. They had assessed her a $70,000 house for like about $200,000, but she was living in an area where majority, you know, non-white people lived at. So obviously, you know, we know that there are white casualties in the system of racism, but it's so interesting when we were, you know, we're talking about, you know, how the previous Cook County assessor, who was Joe Berrios, who is classified as Hispanic, but he can identify as white as well. Basically, he's a white Spanish speaking person. But they asked him at a town hall meeting before he was elected out as the Cook County assessor what was his formula of assessing property taxes, and he could not come up with a clear answer, which is actually surprising because, you know, races normally have clever answers to, you know, to a lot of things, but he couldn't come up with anything. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But I can see this expanding far beyond Chicago, Detroit. They're probably doing it in Baltimore, New York, you know, and all the other areas where, you know, non-white people live at. So that's all I have right now.
Much obliged. Okay. Much obliged. I'm still hearing it. That is crazy. Craziness with the headphones. I'll try and figure that out as we proceed. Anyway, much obliged. Henry in Chicago, they were treating the white woman there like a Negro. That's when it became news. Stealing property from black people, money from black people, children from black people, genetic material from black, anything really, is not really news, even if it's from dozens of black people. But treating one white woman like a Negro, that is news. And I believe, is the Chicago Sun-Times a so-called black newspaper? Maybe I'm in error.
Not at all.
It is a so-called black newspaper?
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh, okay, got you. No. Thank you. Thought I was in there. Not a black newspaper. Thank you. But then it becomes news. Fascinating. System of racism, white supremacy. Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Oh, wow, he called in. That's amazing. With all the festivities that are going on in Chicago, they have the NBA All-Star Game and concerts galore. I have been in a city that is hosting the All-Star Game. Wow. You can party all night long. Like, I think that's the only time I attempted to go to the grocery store at 5 a.m. and it was bumper-to-bumper traffic. It was All-Star Weekend. Be safe if you are in Chicago. Other folks, I'll give out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Talk about constructive use of time and energy. I said that about Valentine's Day. That is another one. I mean, wow, the amount of victims where white people can convince us that this is really important. We should invest our time and energy for, you know, the weekend's festivities and go to all these parties and all the rest of it. Like, it is amazing. I mean, what are priorities if we are in a system of white supremacy, racism? Having to have accurate understanding of what that means helps you have correct priorities for use of time and energy. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? You can go ahead.
Well, thank you, sir. This is Mo from Dallas. Thank you, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I'm here with my seven-year-old daughter. And seven-and-a-half-year-old, my apologies. And I would like to speak to the black female point. Coming from, like, it, and this is, I want to be as relatable as possible with this statement. Anyone who's experienced, like, attention from a black grandmother, like, would feel a certain type of energy. Like, if they refer to their black grandmother as, like, a female. Like, it's not like someone disrespecting your grandfather. So I think... when people refer to black women as females, like, and they understand that that's a demeaning term, like they aspire to be females more than males nowadays. A lot of males do. So there's a divinity there. So it's to be respected, I think. And that's why that term is such a trigger word. As far as something we ate today, we had blueberries and raspberries with pancakes for breakfast. And it was my daughter's idea to put chocolate on the berries. I never done it before, and it was actually very good. Thank you, and I mute my line.
Love blueberry. That is amazing. 7.5. Get it accurate. 7.5. Your old daughter, that is amazing. Hope it's worthy of your time and energy. I love blueberries. I had blueberries in my smoothie. I mentioned that I love blueberries. I really love fresh blueberries. I'm waiting anxiously for springtime. That's why I said Toronto blueberry cobbler. It'll be fresh blueberries. Eat things that are in season. That's interesting. It's still not symmetrical because I don't hear that with, you know, grandpa. Like, why wouldn't it be the same thing with grandpa? I mean, they had signs saying, you know, I'm a man. Why wouldn't it be, you know, you're not going to call my grandpa male. Like, he's a man. Like, I've never heard. I'm just noting the difference. That could be, I guess, but that concern does not seem to be symmetrical. No concern about grandpa being a male, but. Uncle Dokel, Imhan DC, yielded. Much obliged, sir.
Yes, sir. Your line was distorted on my end, what I was hearing, but I could hear the words you were saying. It was just.
Same here.
I'm sorry? Yeah, okay, same there. Yeah. But I could hear the words you were saying, though. What did I eat today? Well, I had a lot of water, just had some water a moment ago. I fried some bananas this morning. It's kind of odd, but I liked it. Had some peanut butter and jelly, had some black bean burgers, had some cabbage and Brussels sprouts and some spaghetti with broccoli and onions and mushroom, a couple other things. So that was the food. I've been pretty good being vegan. I've convinced myself I don't really need to eat meat. I wanted to say, of course, I'm an American, and when I was shopping to get my food, I went through the line, and a black lady was the cashier, and I had $20 in my pocket, and I forgot my card. I didn't have the card in my pocket, my bank card, so I would have just gotten everything, but I was over, 80 cents. I put a little code in. Now it's over 60 cents. So it's like $20.60, and all I have is 20. I asked the lady, can I go back to my car so I can get the 60 cents? And she said, no, she's going to take care of it. I was insisting, I'll do it. Well, there was a white guy who was the bagger. And she walked off from the cash, from the register. And I was like, well, I told the white guy, I'm just going to put that water back. So don't worry about putting it in my bag, in my basket. And the lady comes back, black lady. And I told her, I'm just going to take off this water. She said, no, I told you, I got it. So she took care of it. And when she when she gave the, put the 60 cents in, this white guy, he had some gloves or something, and he took it and he threw it on the counter in protest. It's a young guy. I thought that was just a little, that was interesting. I think that would have been workplace racism for her workplace, and I was just there trying to eat. But anyway, this if the food isn't good in the areas that I'm shopping, really the best place to shop is Whole Foods. They have real food there, I think, because that's where the white people shop. Like the richer or more important ones, they shop over there. So that's why I really go shop. But yeah, so I'm getting a call. But anyway, thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. He said Brussels sprouts. Woo! Could eat Brussels sprouts every day. I had them twice this week already. Love Brussels sprouts. I proselytize for Brussels sprouts. We'll see if we can have them in Toronto. You can be an absolutely happy vegan and eat. I'm so proud to hear people making changes to their diet, eating well, see how your body feels, see how you feel. If you think any better, feel any better, notice any changes, give it a little time. But you can eat really well, be full, feel great, well taken care of. Let's see. Other folks, wait a minute. I just want to get in. I'll share it later. Other folks who dialed in, if you have observations, thoughts, comments, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Is my microphone any better now?
Yes, sir.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter. Thank you, Imhan DC, for pointing that out as well. It was, I was trying to figure out. Thank you. Much obliged. Other folks that dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we've missed you totally, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, listeners. Good evening, participants. Today's menu was not as constructive as I had wished, but I am particularly pleased that I've been making more dishes for myself. Today, I actually had a dish that I had made previously. It was baked tofu and potatoes and broccoli with sautéed onions, red and white, and green pepper, garlic, and seasoned with some thyme, chili pepper, onion powder, onion powder, garlic powder, some red wine vinegar, and tamari sauce. I made a pot of it, and I was using it for lunch. So that was the one good dish that I made for myself today, and I've been following part of Dr. Lathan's suggestion of at least making one plant-based dish for the day. So that was that. That was that. I guess I have a question. I came across a podcast series addressing the practice of racism in area of education specifically related to me in my immediate area of New York City. I think I vaguely recall you might have talked about it in the teacher strike of 1968 in Brooklyn, New York. Do you recall talking about that?
I don't remember having like a specific broadcast where that was like the focus. It may have come up in passing, I'm sure. That seems very likely, but I don't think there's like a program where we were like in depth for like 2 hours on that.
Okay. All right. I was hoping to have the counter-racist perspective on it, but like I said, it's been quite fascinating. But I have to go back. I think I have to go back into 2018 because I think it might have been a part of one of the compensatory call-in shows. I think you might have mentioned it. Other questions, like I said, just like a lot of random questions for me tonight. Do you still carry a tactical pen?
Placed it, so I know I do not.
You should. I'll email you. Like I said, maybe I'll send you one. I just ordered a whole set of for myself. And to the overreaching question, that's interesting to the pushback about the
your use of the term, or the use of the term black female. I've found that it should be a symmetry, right? And I do understand the symmetry of it, because, like I said, when you look at it, it should, you know what I'm saying, it shouldn't be any pushback, but I do find it interesting. I have to think further about it before I actually offer any other opinions. I had one last question before I run out of time. Do anybody have strategies of dealing with fellow victims who are particularly, I don't want to say rude, what's the word, off-putting, or you're trying to avoid conflict with them? Because I think, like I said, I've been my current trajectory has been talking about my promotion to a supervisor, and today was an interesting interaction with somebody who, like I said, who I didn't know. And I just, you know, I want to go introduce myself. She was a black female, and she was very standoffish, if that's the most accurate term I can think of right now, to my overture. You know, I went to introduce myself, and she seemed to not want to be bothered with me. So I was looking for strategies of, just like I said, I know it could be a workplace racism topic, but it's just in general, when you try to introduce yourself to people, and have you come up with a strategy to overcome the initial coldness of fellow victims? And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Workplace racism. Thursday, or excuse me, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And 5 p.m. Pacific. Fridays, workplace racism. We have suggestions, thoughts, trying our best to solve the problem, racism, white supremacy. If you have a non-white person in a workplace context who is, I guess, not being courteous, you just try to introduce yourself, and they seem like they're not interested in speaking to you, I would be courteous to them. The same way that we had the caller who dialed in before, I'm not your brother. I've said that consistently for the workplace. We are not thinking just because this is a black person, male or female, this is my homie, this is my friend, not thinking that. Another victim of racism who racists might use to mistreat me on the job. So I'm going to be courteous with this person. If it seems like, Gavin DeBecker, he says you trust your instincts. If it seems like this person is not really responding like they want to talk to me too much, seem like they don't want to be around me, no problem. I will be courteous, minimize contact. When we do have to work together, I am courteous, professional. Leave it at that. If she mistreats me anything, I would, you know, respond accordingly, but it would just be minimize contact, be courteous, be professional, and I'm not thinking that this is my homie at all. If other folks have suggestions they would offer for dealing with a victim in the workplace who seems like they are not your homie, you could add those as we proceed. If we have missed you totally, and you have a hand up, *61 to raise your hand. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard? I've already spoken, but nobody spoke up. So can I be heard, please, sir?
We can't.
Yeah, I'll wait. I'll wait. Okay.
There are other folks who have not spoken. If you could maybe just give 1 second, we'll see.
Yes,
and
sir.
Then if not, you can share your thoughts. The folks, spectators that we have missed totally who do have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. I think that the female at the workplace is being codified, especially since I think the gentleman said that he just became a supervisor. So, you know, she's keeping it, you know, pretty work-related, cordial. You know, not going to share too much information with the supervisor. I think that's a codified behavior. Of someone who's, you know, not looking to kiss someone, you know, kiss up to someone, so to speak. Detroit, the second highest property taxes in the U.S., United States. And I said, this can't be true. So I had to look it up. That was Congresswoman Tlaib, I believe, if that's who that was. Very dangerous. Watch her closely. Very dangerous. But yeah, Detroit was number two. It was Bridgeport, Connecticut, Detroit, Aurora, Illinois, North New Jersey, and Milwaukee. Aurora is a white Chicago suburb where I can see them having high taxes to keep black people out and, you know, also to keep black people out of their suburb, you know, altogether, having police and things that which would take a high tax base. Bridgeport and Milwaukee are both the largest cities in their respective states. Both cities have a disproportionately high percentage of blacks compared to the state average, meaning that that's the number one place for the state's black tax base. And Newark and Detroit are both called chocolate cities. So just very interesting. Seems to me that in the blacker areas, or Detroit and Newark, taxes can be being used to make the place less attractive to live for black people. You know, racially motivated violence, I believe that was the term that the police used for these white hate groups. It sounds like a bunch of black people are going to jail for this term. It's like the hate crime. It's not really, you're not really being direct with the terminology. Like a black identity extremist, as vague as it is, it's pretty direct. Racially motivated violence to target white supremacist group. Why don't they just call it white supremacist group, you know, task force or something? It's being very vague, and it's that usually means that they could turn it around and use it against us. As for Bernie, as for the Democrats in politics, because I'm pretty convinced 4 more years, they're trying to steal the election from Bernie again. The problem is this time they don't have an alternative. Biden would have been the guy, but he's so tainted with him and his son's involvement in Ukraine that they can't run him against Trump. In Iowa, they got exposed stealing the election from Bernie using an app, which is why it took them so long to count the delegates. It took them like 3-4 days. And they gave the election the booty gig. Once again, booty gig is not going to stand a chance against Trump. In fact, you know, he's going to walk out with the first husband. You know, Trump's going to make jokes about that. I mean, he's going to, no chance at all. Which is going back to, you know, my thoughts is going to be Hillary again eventually jumping in, because they really have no one. I'm looking at the name, Klobuchar, no chance. There's no chance, not a remote chance. The stabbing that took place in New York City a few months ago involving a white student at Barnard College at Columbia University, I believe Taya something. I don't want to butcher the white woman's name. She was stabbed to death.
they went and arrested a bunch of young teenage black children. The reports all over the news were they weren't going to have another Central Park case. They were going to take their time and make sure that this is done right, make sure that they have all the evidence so it'll never be disputed. And you have, as they said, quote unquote, fear to these young men. So today, months later, they came out, and it's been all over the news, New York One all day, that they finally arrested one more person, and this, they're going to take these two that they, one that they had in custody, another one that they arrested today, 113, 114. They're going to take them to court. They're trying them as adults, second-degree murder, first-degree burglary. These two young men, young males, apparently had this, the white girls, she had their skin under her nails. So she was, as they were stealing her cell phone, they're saying she, tried to fight back and one of them stabbed her. However, trying them as adults, I noticed that is a trend when black people, yes, young black males, commit crimes against white people. That's generally how they get charged. I believe if this was a black female that got stabbed in the park, probably wouldn't have been solved. But I don't think they would have been tried as adults because, of course, they're not going to value that black female's life as much as this white woman. And I'm on my line. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Tessa Majors. I believe is her name, Tessa Majors, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, the white woman, the new charges that were announced today, charging them as adults, typical for non-white children. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast. If you're listening in, I think you have a thought, suggestion, question you would like to share, do not wait until the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up if you would like to share. We have a little less than 30 minutes left in the broadcast. Are there folks that we've missed totally who have a hand up?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. As far as the diet, I am still trying to make improvements. I've been using a seasoning for an omelet that I made with onions and mushroom. It doesn't have any salt in it, and I've been drinking these vegan waters called, I believe it's called Hint, that's the brand name, and it has like an apple flavoring, and I've been also trying to not only tell people at work, but just really get into drinking water in general. Like, it doesn't have to be flavored, but at best, just plain water, cold or room temperature. And I did go and buy some bananas and fruits and more salads. As far as the term black female and black male, I do agree it should be more symmetrical in terms of the, why not say anything when the word black male is used. I just think it's for some reason, obviously I think it's the system of white supremacy and the media reinforcing those toxic stereotypes of black males being criminals or rapists, and even when exemplify in a bad way, Kobe Bryant passing, how the white woman said that it was, I think, karma or something like that, and he still had an effect on people's lives who not only wants to play basketball but just in many other aspects. And I do think that
it should be equivalent if one term is being used that I think, well, people don't agree on it being used, it should be equally seen with the term black male as well. As far as the audio segment, the racist suspect, Bloomberg, running for president, I did see a segment where I think Trump was saying that he's a racist. So one person who says things that are things a racist would say, president is calling Michael Bloomberg a racist, said that, hey, if you were, you know, this person said if you were black, you were being stopped during stop and frisk two times a day if you're black, or something of that effect. I thought that was interesting, especially when it comes to when the election time comes around. You know, we got to get the black vote, and people are in the churches and clapping, and it's like, this isn't authentic. Okay, so you have the people who are non-white that were trying to, I guess, get the Democratic nomination, and all of them are gone. So it's just more nothing but white people left. So racism is being practiced right there. And there was a report here near the county that I'm in that they was using this term gun sanctuaries for, I think it was, I don't know if it was Gilchrist County, it's a couple of counties that, I think, yeah, Bradford County was one of them. And I never heard of the term gun sanctuary. And I saw another news report locally that there was a bunch of white people that were talking about they were being, I guess, harassed by law enforcement, you know, sheriffs or whatever, that they had guns in their holsters. So they held this big meeting about, I guess, trying to get some kind of law change. And they gave the microphone to one white man, and he was like, oh, well, this is just ridiculous. You know, criminals don't hold guns in their holster or something like that. So that's obvious codification. You're talking about somebody non-white, you know, black person. When there was a story where it was a black male went into a Walmart, and some random white Walmart customer approached him and physically attacked him and tried to take his gun off of him, and come to find out he owned that gun, firearm legitimately. He had a permit. So once again, like, that's a part of how black males have been, and black people in general, but black males have been definitely had negative stereotypes attributed to us. That's my point of view on that. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I do think that is important, just to think about people who, you know, not that I'm opposed to it at all, but just if you are carrying, because I think there have been other examples of that sort of thing where a black person was a legal Second Amendment law-abiding firearm owner. The shooting in Dallas, Micah Xavier Johnson, he was never convicted, so alleged shooter in Dallas, Texas, summer of 2016. They said he shot those enforcement officers. There was a black male who was there, legal Second Amendment gun owner. They were circulating pictures. He did it. Get that coon. People were talking and posting his picture online. Like, he went right to the enforcement officials when the shooting happened. Handed over his long rifle, spoke to everyone, was released, law-abiding citizen. I did nothing wrong. And so that's very common system of white supremacy, racism. Man not, woman not. Let's see. Caller on the Skype line, did you have a question, comment, suggestion?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I had a very constructive meal. I had some broccoli stir-fried with some avocado oil, boiled pasta, chia seeds, flax seeds. And I just went crazy with the chia seeds. It was really delicious. Still slightly hungry, but I think it's better to be a little bit hungry after a meal. And I just wanted to talk about the stop and frisk. I've been targeted for stop and frisk one time on a street in downtown. And I didn't really challenge the law enforcement officer. I just capitulated, you know. But he asked to see me. He asked me to see my some proof of ID, and I just crossed the street from punching out from work. So he says, "Hey, can I see some ID?" So I just showed him. I didn't really get into any kind of long conversations to ask him why. But anyway, I gave it to him, and then he said, "Go." I mean, I'm starting to get the feeling, you know, that due process and equal protection of the law do not apply to black males, you know. And I don't know what's going to go on. I don't know what's going on in this world. I do have a feeling that it has something, what we may call white supremacy. And I do live in Canada. And I just want to let everybody know that Canada is not the fun-loving country that you might think that it is. And from my experience, it is the refined racism capital of North America, because when people practice racism here, they're very polite about it. They'll have this uncomfortable laugh, you know, and they'll make jokes about racism. They'll go, "Oh, you're racist," and then they'll make racism like if it's some kind of a joke. And I look back on how I behaved in certain times, and I would laugh along with them, even though at the same time when I'm laughing, I'm actually demeaning myself, because that joke is really on me. So, you know, it's just a thought, you know. I mean, due process and equal protection under the law is under the Constitution, and it's also under the law in the U.S. of A. So replace racism with justice immediately, as Gus would say. I will mute my line now.
You all ate pretty well, or at least, you know, got in one meal that was not too bad. Love the chia seeds, stir-fry veggies. Spectacular. Let's see. Let me give out the number again. It is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We will be in the aforementioned Canada, Toronto, May 21 through May 24. Someone wrote a comment and they said, "Why are you going to Toronto? Isn't that place racist?" And I said, "Wait a minute. Do you know any location in the known universe where we could go and racism would not be a problem?" I'm still waiting for a response. Anywho, May 21, May 24, Toronto Counter Racist Yoga Retreat. We are still learning. I think for many of us, that is very common to be in situations where white supremacy racism is being practiced, and we're not really sure what the best way to respond would be. We might even be unsure if it's white supremacy racism, and we just kind of laugh, smile to just go along, not rock the boat metaphor that they'll use, to not challenge racists. Might be some fear there on our part as well. But I think when you start to have a better understanding, sometimes you come up with questions or things better to do than just snicker, laughing when things are not funny. I did want to quickly, Imhan DC, the scene where he said he was getting his groceries or what have you. He brought a 20, was going real quick, forgot his bank card, and I was a black teller. And I think the bill came to 20.60. Like I said, he had a 20. He said, "Oh, I got, you know, 60 cent, no problem, I'll get that for you." And he was kind of insistent, like, "Oh, no, I'll, you know, run to the car or whatever, or just put this water." She said, "No, I got it, 60 cent, black self-respect. I love it. Just being willing to help out. Not that that's, you know, loaning you the down payment on a house or anything, but I mean, you know, 60 cents, right on. If that will help you get through the day, you know, hey, you get everything that you need and move along right on. I always love it. If it's something that I can do, I have the power to do, to assist another black person, it is constructive. I like doing that and accepting, too, because I think we get conditioned. They'll call you names. They'll call you a butcher and that sort of thing if you ask for help or somebody tries to help you, right, in the system of racism. So I think accepting, if it's constructive assistance from a black person, let them help. You know, be thankful for that. That's great. Particularly seeing how, the reason I say that is compounded, seeing how the white person responded. I mean, it's not like
breaking
you know,
up.
Oh no!
You're breaking up.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're breaking up.
So it's not like she loaned Imhan DC $1 million, right? It's not like he got a house, as I said, a car, a cruise, none of that. Just 60 cents. That was enough. Slamming items down on the counter. Earth. Can't believe. Niggers not being hostile with each other. Talk about that on a regular basis. Just black people getting along constructively. Seems like it jeopardizes the system of white supremacy racism. He was about to have an aneurysm. Other folks, if we missed you totally, again, do not wait until the last moment. And if folks have suggestions for workplace racism, what to do when you feel like it's a victim of racism who is not very receptive to you, that would be great. The male caller who just gave me the audio check, thank you for speaking up. You had commentary.
I actually did, Gus. And when you were speaking earlier, as far as the homie, that I really got offended because you was in your voice inflection when you actually said it. You was like the homies, like your voice changed and your voice inflection changed, but. When you look at different demographics, different parts of the country, those words like brother, like homie, those words are really powerful. Those words mean a lot. I mean, you know, my homie, you know, I mean, if you, any language, God or whatever could be called different names in different languages, but you know, the way your voice changed and you kind of mocked it, that homie is real. I've seen actual people die for other people that they consider their homies. And, I mean, yeah, it might sound cliche or it might sound, you know, ghetto or whatever the case may be. But that's my problem with brothers in arms, brothers in the struggle, brothers in, you know, under the umbrella of white insanity. You know, it doesn't mean that we have to end, and I totally get it, Gus, when, who was that? Was it Neely Fuller or whoever said, you can't call yourself a man if this people is oppressing you? Yes, you can. Yes, you can call yourself a man. Yeah, you're a victim of certain circumstances, but you're still a man. You are a man, and for you to say that I'm not a man because yeah, I'm allowing myself to be victimized by a certain group of people that has a certain agenda that supersedes our evilness or whatever the case it may be. This may be a whole lot of metaphors, I don't know, but homies, brothers, those are real actual terms to certain people. And I feel kind of offended that you negate that, like you downplay it. These things are real to certain people. There's certain people that...
30 seconds.
No, I'm done. Thank you, brother. Peace. Thank you, Mr. Gus. Thank you. Peace.
Much obliged. The person that called in from I guess if you called in on the Skype line, if we've missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Greetings, everyone, hosts, callers, and listeners. I'm a long-time listener. Can I be heard right now?
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. Yes, I'm a long-time listener, learner, first-time caller. Thank you for letting me share tonight. I stay in Portland, one thing that ate, okay. Let's see here. I ate a smoothie for my breakfast with turmeric and maca root in there, and blend it up with my blender, and I drink that down. And then I ate some Cash organic peanut butter cereal. Then I had a veggie burger for dinner. I also practice being vegetarian myself. Like I was saying, I stay in Portland, Oregon, and this is one of the most refined places that I ever stayed in. I'm from Tacoma, Washington, and I heard that you was also staying in Seattle, Gus, so I also know that area. But I stay in Portland, Oregon, and they label the city White Haven, the White Utopia. So myself, I land myself being less confused. And I don't mind staying around here because I'm not looking for friends and looking to be associates with people. I'm looking to also replace the system with justice. So therefore, I'm really serious about what I'm trying to do. You know, when I look at the word allow, I see a lot of, I hear a lot of people that use that word allow. And one thing that I understand with the word allow, it means to give permission to do something. And it also means to permit, to let, to authorize, to give someone permission to, give authorization, to sanction, to grant someone the right, the license. And this is the key words I really love, is to empower, to enable, to entitle, to qualify. So when I look at all those words, like we say, words are important. When I look at the word empower, and like with me staying in Portland, Oregon, I stay in a neighborhood that used to be black, what people used to say, so to speak. And about 5 years ago, they came in and they want to make the neighborhood unblack. So right down the street where I stay at, it's called the Mississippi District. And that is now pretty much like a little white college town that is pretty much specifically for white people, white races, and white supremacists, because where I say that, that's pretty much that's all around. Like the person said that stays in Canada, the racism here is pretty much the same way. But when people are not on code and they're less aware of what's even happening, then it's just kind of like they pretty much just going to keep on doing what they do, the way I look at it. And when we were stating about the black female word, I always go back to what Nellie Fuller states. And I look at it like the only race is white people in a system of racism, white supremacy. So a white female would be the only woman in that system, pretty much, period. And there's a song by a rapper, Razzcaz, and the song is called White Power. And I would invite anyone to listen to that song. That song explains in detail the system of racism, white supremacy. Once again, the rapper is Razzcaz. His name is spelled R-A-S-K-A-S. KASS, Raskass. And the song, once again, is called White Power. Let me see here. You know, also, I heard people talking about language. I've been criticized by people for them, in my opinion, miscommunicating with me or having a miscommunication, where I believe communication is someone speaking, someone listening, and then there's going to be some understanding in the middle there. And people was coming to me and having this real aggressive language where they was calling me brother, comrade, black man, this man, that man, where it just became a real breakdown in communication. So I started to understand that sometimes communication can bring people together, but it also can tear people apart. Language can also start conflicts that leads to violence or death when people simply just don't agree. That's it. Just, I had a guy that stayed around me. He wanted to keep, or kept trying to attempt to argue with me. And once I just told him, I said, well, it seems like we don't really agree on anything. I don't understand why you keep wanting to have this communication. He told me that, well, a real man would want to debate and argue to see who the real man is. And my response to him was that, well, the only man I see in the system is the white man, and I don't want to sit around and argue and fight with you with words to prove that the only man is him, but I can pretty much already see that. I was born in the system. Like I said, I'm from Tacoma, Washington. And so when you're born pretty much around white supremacists and racists, that was pretty much my class right there, just being in the atmosphere and around these people every day. But myself, I was on code, because I looked at it like my skin was the uniform that I was born with. So I already knew that I was enemy number one to them. Even when I went to school, in society, it didn't matter where I went, I already knew that I was their enemy as they waged war against the people who looked like me years ago. So therefore, it was pretty simple and plain to me that my only job was to
30 seconds?
Was try to replace the system with like-minded people like yourself. So that's why I no longer want to be a spectator, a silent spectator. I want to call in and just let people know I'm here in Portland, Oregon, where it is one of the most refined, racist places on this earth. And thank you for letting me share, and I appreciate this program.
First-time caller. Much obliged for dialing in. Portland is about 3 hours south of Seattle. I've been there a few times. We went to the eclipse. Went to Salem, drove through Portland to get there. I know a beautiful black female yoga instructor in Portland. And Dr. Ruby Lathan, previously mentioned, she's doing a holistic foods workshop in Portland this October. Gus T. Renegade might be teaching yoga at that workshop in Portland, okay, Oregon, this October. Come hang out, smoothies, do a little yoga, see Dr. Lathan, hear some wonderful information, take some yoga with Gus T. Portland area, do it up.
Yes.
Is any folks I've that heard. We missed? Any folks have a final comment they need to get in before we conclude? Got to be brief, like 30 seconds.
Can I say something, Gus? One is when you were talking about the conceal and carry, I believe Xavier Johnson, he was allegedly shot the police in protest of them killing Orlando Castillo, who was gunned down. He had all the proper
credentials and paperwork for holding his gun. I have these two white women at work, and I've noticed that when I come around, they change up the way they talk. Hey, Thomas, what's up, bro? How's it going? You know, it's that, like, you know, little swag and talk with their neck and very interesting. Thank you.
Doesn't get any better than tacky. Anybody else? 30 seconds.
Can I be heard?
Back to, I heard you both go, of you. Let's get retired firefighter. You can go first.
Yes, I was just going to reiterate my code that I shared with the white person. I don't give anybody money at all. And I would have, if I had time to, I would have suggested that to that white person that he goes to somewhere where there's a lot of white people and ask them for their finances and whatnot, that sort of thing. I would also go to a non-white person that asked me for money, and I would either buy them some food. I've done that a couple of times because they're standing right outside in front of the grocery store, or I would ask them to go where white people are at also and ask for a compensatory investment request. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
I wouldn't even invest that much time for a white person.
Oh, no. No. Not for a white person. That's why I kept going. I kept walking after I told them I don't give money to white people.
Gotcha. Henry in Chicago. Oh, I thought that was Henry in Chicago. Was there another caller who spoke up simultaneously with retired firefighter?
Yes, this is Mo from Dallas. Can I be heard?
Sorry about that. Yes, sir.
Speaking to the workplace racism, the black scent when being greeted, I've noticed that there are two types of greetings that I've noticed. One is the really bubbly, like, hey, what's up, homie type of greeting. And if you like receive it well, then they'll continue. Also, if you don't, that greeting will change into like the I'll say it's like a morning or a good morning with no eye contact and like a flat shameful smile. I don't like I've noticed that especially when you acknowledge the hey homie and you just keep giving them a good morning or you don't hey homie them back. You get like a shame smile type of greeting, and then no contact. They'll cease all contact after a while. Black males, older black males, not being defended. I would say that it's not common for people to defend older black males because black males are not common in households. Black females are. So when you see an older black female as a black victim of racism, you feel more inclined to defend her because you can identify with that for a longer period of time than you would a black male. Thank you, and I need my line.
Much obliged. I had quite a bit of contact with two black male grandparents, black male father. I never felt using the term male to describe them was offensive or put down, but that is something to consider. Perhaps that's contributing in some way. Again, I encourage follow logic. What do we mean when we say man? What do we mean when we say woman? Particularly making sure these words are used correctly in the system of white supremacy racism. Very important. striving for universal man, universal woman, not subject to racists, not subject to any unjust oppressor. That is what we're striving for. And I guess I would even add, it's the same logic, you know. Mr. Fuller says, hey, if we already have a community, we're satisfied with what we have. We think black people are awesome and spectacular. Well, then, hey, shouldn't be any participation in this program. If you're already a man, no problem. You're happy with your status? No problem. That male, female, that is a reminder of my status. And it's accurate. Most important, it's accurate. Strive for accuracy. Follow logic. But just make an evaluation. You know, what do we mean when we say man in a system of white supremacy? Anywho, check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook for updates, upcoming programs. I know Franchise, black female author, she will be on the broadcast with us in a matter of days. I've been reading the book. Fascinating. She starts the book with photographs from the McDonald's during the 2014 Ferguson unrest. Lots of folks were at the McDonald's. They were there to get milk for the tear gas. They had to charge their phones. Some journalists got arrested there. Very interesting point to start a book on the history of the McDonald's franchise in the system context of white supremacy racism. Coming soon to the cows. Anywho, much obliged for folks' participation. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Toronto Yoga Retreat, May 21 to May 24. Email if you have questions, need more information, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Preserve your brain computer. Harriet A. Washington says we are awash in noxious alcohol and cigarettes. She says that repeatedly in A Terrible Thing to Waste. In addition to being sober, if you're driving, let's be buckled up every time, driver or passenger. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the little things to stay as safe as possible under conditions of white terrorism. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.